You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
No tenemos que mostrar ningún papel. No tenemos que decirle nada a nadie. Menos a la migra, menos a la migra. Y si la agarran, usted ya sabe qué hacer.
Today on Flashpoints, a special report from the U.S.-Mexico border about the arrest and imprisonment of dozens of Central American refugees. They were arrested this week and, yeah, transported against their will to private prisons. Also, we'll play excerpts from the troubling new documentary, Spies Mississippi. Deep background on the racist Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission meant to foster extreme institutional discrimination against the black community of Mississippi and throughout the South. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned.
Tenemos derecho de mantener silencio. Tenemos derecho de hablarle a un abogado. No tenemos que firmar ni un documento porque es seguro para la deportación.
All right, Francisco Herrera, Dennis Bernstein here. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we've got some very important business to do. Francisco, of course, unites us with the communities to the south, starting in Mexico. Francisco, you've been monitoring the situation at the border because there are several caravans that have arrived at the U.S. Mexico border. We're not sure where everybody is being taken, but we do have some information that at least some of the folks who were arrested have been taken against their will to private prisons.
Yeah, so Sunday there was at least 78 people, Dennis, as you know. Well, good afternoon, all our radio listeners and friends out there. Sunday there was at least 78 people that crossed into the U.S. border and asked and demanded for political asylum, given the violence and the realities they are living and facing. And this included families, as you know, Dennis. The normal situation would have been, or the regular humane situation would have been, to you apply for political asylum, people take your case on with a local judge that is right there, and they at most give you a grillete, a bracelet, an electric bracelet to monitor where you're at the most.
And course, many of these people had either relatives or friends.
No, yeah, almost every
country. People were being spoken for.
Oh, yeah,
and
exactly.
Instead of releasing them into the arms, after so much suffering, instead of releasing them into the arms of those who love them, who are ready to care for them, they stuck them in private prisons.
Right, because it follows the whole logic of these people aren't people. First of all, they're bad people, or at most they're bad people, but at least they're not even people, right? And that's the logic that the Trump administration had been pushing. Of course, the Obama administration pretty much followed a very similar pattern, that we don't exist, that there's no violence in Honduras, that it's a lie about El Salvador, that everything's fine and dandy in Mexico, when we have had at least 250,000 people have been murdered now in Mexico in the last 6 years.
250,000. 250,000 people.
Sure, the conservative numbers are saying about 150,000 that they're counting, of course, right?
Yeah.
So these families have decided to take a stand, and they crossed over on Sunday and said, here we are, unarmed, here we are as families, and we seek political asylum. What we are fleeing is violence, and we do fear for our lives. The Trump administration, through its ICE agency, decided to put people in jail. Now, today is Friday, the 12th of May, and we do know that there's at least four families of adults with children who've been released. But guess what the ICE authorities did? The rest of the families have been sent to a family detention center in Texas. And just for people who are like that to talk about or to think about, the cost and the kind of corruption that's going on between the U.S. government and these private prisons and detention centers, the U.S. government, our tax dollars, are going to pay these private prisons $157 per day per person. The electronic bracelet that they would have given in a normal situation would have been about $4.40 per day, Dennis. So it just shows you the level of corruption we're facing in the cahoots that government agencies are now playing with private contractors that have chosen to make the prison industry a for-profit business.
And the stocks are
soaring.
It's doing quite well on the stock market.
Yeah. And, you know, the families like the Prince family, the brother of the woman who's now faking as the director of public education at the Washington, D.C.
Secretary of Education.
Right, Secretary of
Betsy DeVos, her brother is
from Blackwater. And those are the kind of folks that are profiting off of families being unjustly held in detention centers. And so right now, the process, I got this information from Nicole Ramos.
We can't reach her right now.
We couldn't reach her today because, she's right at the detention center, and there's, on purpose, there's a black spot or a dark spot or whatever they call it now, where you can't really get through the internet or phone or cell phones. But what she told me is right now the folks are going through the process of the interview, and they are helping people be processed through that. We will be hearing more information as the days go. We can have people search in and call into ICE to at least find out what's happening with these families. We know that there's more families that are coming across
this weekend. I believe there's several dozen more folks on a caravan from Central America, I believe, from
Guatemala.
That's
correct. Yeah. Now, there is a beauty and the beast story in this whole thing. The beast being, of course, the train that many of these families have gotten on, Dennis. And the beauty of it is the people itself, right? The beauty and the beast story. In three ways is the beauty. One is the women and families who have organized themselves throughout Mexico to feed these families that are passing on this big train.
And, celebrate their lives.
Right, this train called the Beast. Secondly, it is the actual people who've taken on a role, not just of feeding, but now, you know, the government has used these ex or gang members to assault folks who are on the trains.
Right.
And now there's a self-defense body that's being built, and where actually you have people on the train cars protecting the families that are coming along. And Alex Mansings talked a little bit how he himself felt protected by these folks who are basically kind of witnessing, but they also have sticks and stuff like that to defend themselves. And the third beauty of the whole process is the people themselves who've taken on this journey. It's such a courageous stage of saying, I'm moving forward. There are families for all of these people that are crossing. There are families here in the States that are saying, yes, I am willing to be a host. And they're saying that to the government. So the fact that the Trump administration decided to put these people in jail just to be inhumane
abusive,
and sadistic in a way.
And to feed into the private prison industry.
Well, the bottom line
is a major corporate sponsor of the Trump administration.
Yeah.
This is like a direct thing.
Yeah.
He's going to make money on this prison operation.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And this is where we as a citizenry have to become much more aware and much more on their doorstep, on their email, on their phone line, saying we will not accept this profiteering business of the suffering of people for dollars for the Trump administration friends.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is Dennis Bernstein, and Francisco Herrera is sitting to my right here in the KPFA studios. By the way, this is a fundraising hour, so you can call without even a pitch, right? You can just call because you understand that the work we do here on Fridays, our connections with this brown community, with this emerging rebellion, with the new brown majority of the United States of America, the connection that we've had for 15 years, you know what we do here. Anyway, what we're going to do right now, we'll give you the number, 1-800-439-5732. I'm going to need a sheet in there sometime before the end of this show. But we've got a guest, a surprise guest, in the studio. Why don't you introduce us to our guest? And I think it looks like he's holding an instrument, too. I mean, he's way over there. So it's hard to tell. No,
my good brother here is Lolo Cutumay, a heroic leader of the People's Movement in El Salvador. Was one of the founding members of a great musical group in El Salvador, Cutumay Camones. A survivor of tremendous attack and violence on the people of El Salvador by our tax dollars and U.S. military
adventures, yes.
For anti-democratic purposes.
Anyway, thank you, Lolo, to the School of Americas.
Yeah. Lolo has been active here in the United States after coming here through continued cultural endeavor, cultural work. And he's here tonight because tomorrow we are going to be honored by his wonderful voice and musicianship in San Francisco at the offices of the Answer Coalition. It's 2969 Mission Street between 25th and 26th. And Lolo's here with us with his Cuatro Venezolano. And welcome very much, Lolo. Lolo Cutumay, thank you for being with us.
Gracias. Gracias por el espacio que me están dando aquí en San Francisco, KFK, esta hermosa radio comunitaria, ¿no? Ya que también en Los Ángeles creo que hay otra radio KPFK y por ahí tengo también un amigo con un programa hispano, ¿no?
Thank you very much for having me here. I'm very happy to be here in the radio waves of KPFA. We've also shared some time with a sister station, KPFK, in Los Angeles. So I'm very happy to be here with you all. Lolo, a lo mejor nos quieras decir un poquito de lo que vas a hacer mañana en el concierto. Lolo, you could tell us a little bit of what the concert is for tomorrow in San Francisco at 6:30 p.m.
Y mañana vamos a traer un repertorio bastante bonito, adecuado para el momento en que estamos viviendo, ¿no? Y vamos a cantar canciones como recordando lo que fue nuestra historia en aquellos tiempos de conflicto en nuestro país, El Salvador.
So we have a repertoire of music adaptable very much for our times today, and we will also remember musically many of the stories, many of the experiences we had in previous time in El Salvador during the war there.
Yeah.
A lo mejor nos puedes dar un ejemplo de lo que vas a cantar.
Y te puedo cantar una canción, como digo, recordando aquellos momentos difíciles, ¿no? Aunque obviamente pues ahora tenemos un gobierno democrático de amplia participación, pero es muy importante que los jóvenes de esta época conozcan lo que fue nuestra historia, y precisamente pues la música de Cutumay Camones es como una parte educativa, ¿no? Que entra dentro del programa, recogiendo nuestra historia, nuestras raíces históricas.
So yeah, one of the songs, the song that I'll do, sure, covers some of the history, and it's important, even though now we have a government that we have won in El Salvador, but it's important for the younger folks to be able to remember a bit of that story, a bit of the history that we created back in those times.
Yeah, por ejemplo, en esta oportunidad, pues quizás voy a cantar El Tiempo No Lo Tenemos tan amplio, ¿no? Pero voy a cantar un par de estrofas de una canción de lo que en aquellos años cantábamos, como Cutumay Camones.
So, given our limitation in time, I'm going to sing a couple of phrases from a song that we sang back in those days as a group, Cutumay Camones.
We can do the song.
Podemos cantar toda la canción.
We can do the song. La página necesita el libro. Necesito el libro.
Bueno, popurrí.
Vamos a cantar que sea como un popurrí, digamos. Ok.
Levántate, clase pobre, que la hora ya llegó. De tomar la cosa en serio y liberar el Salvador. La patria te necesita con tu puño y con tu voz. Disparemos los fusiles y gritemos revolución. Ay, mira que la hora ya llegó y no se puede estar de espectador. La lucha es del pueblo y sin parar hasta lograr el triunfo popular. Ay, mira que la hora ya llegó y no se puede estar de espectador. La lucha es del pueblo y sin parar hasta lograr el triunfo popular. Y aprender a fabricar el armamento popular. Intérense a la guerrilla, los que puedan disparar, para así poder estar listos para el pequeño final. Ay, mira que la hora ya llegó, no se puede estar de espectador. La lucha es del pueblo y sin parar, hasta lograr el triunfo. Ay, mira que la hora ya llegó y no se puede estar de espectador. La lucha es del pueblo y sin parar hasta el triunfo popular. Ay, mira que la hora ya llegó y no se puede estar de espectador. La lucha es del pueblo y sin parar hasta el triunfo popular.
All right, thank you. And again, the name of that song?
El nombre de la canción, The Time Is Here, The Time Is Now, La Hora Ya Llegó.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Francisco Herrera on a guest in the studio. Concerts coming up. Francisco, well, this is sort of the time of the show that we usually do the tip of the week, which is this is about survival in the age of Trump. For as long as he lasts, it looks like he may be unraveling a little bit. And remember, you know, it's never... They never get you on what they accuse you of.
Right.
They get you on the cover-up. And this guy is definitely bait for the kind of stuff they love to do. So he's in a bit of a trouble. But nevertheless, that doesn't stop him from creating
chaos.
Incredible chaos and great suffering. And that's one of the things he's been able to continue to do despite all the various things going on in Washington. It's almost as if this is like he's going to make this happen no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
The brown communities of the United States are going to suffer.
Yeah, we're definitely facing a belligerent attack from this man and this administration, including Bannon and all the other folks that are intent on changing our perspective from the real problems in this country and creating distractions, one of which is the attack on migrant people, of course. But it really is an attack on all of the working class, because the goal of the administration of Trump is slavery. I mean, I think we have to be very clear about this. And so the tip of the week that we focus on, knowing that the majority of listeners here are folks who do have citizenship, who do have papers, who have some kind of documentation, is how do we support and how do we create a space that represents the best of all of us together, no? It's very interesting, Dennis. Last week, the tip of the week had to do with precisely what we're doing here with Lolo, which is creating a space tomorrow of celebration, of organizing, of telling knowing with ourselves that we in fact are winning this campaign of human beings in solidarity with each other, supporting a working class society, right? People's government, people efforts. And that came because in fact what we're seeing in the schools, despite our greatest efforts to really help ourselves to don't talk to the immigration or don't open the door, is what we're seeing in the schools right now is really children being terrorized by the very action of our communities trying to defend themselves. So this is, goes out to all the teachers, all the social workers, all the families. We have to be very clear about one thing, folks. During the earthquake of 1989, we discovered in our work that the children who were with parents who were not stunned by the earthquake, who reacted in a very normal way or healthy way, those children did not experience trauma. But the children who were with either with teachers or with parents or with adults who got scared and panicked, those children experienced trauma. So the tip of the day is, of the week, is as we go about our work to protect ourselves, we have to make the space for our kids to feel safe. Not to have these conversations of fear and trauma and what's going to happen, and because the kids soak this stuff up like a sponge. And what kids do when we're kids, what we do is we feel we're the center of the world. So when we feel responsible for our parents' fears, we feel responsible for the fears that the adult is experiencing. Yes. So the tip of the week is really that as we go about our organizing work, we have to consider that our children are listening to everything we say. So we have to do it in such a way that they feel protected, not exposed. So be very careful of the language that we use and how we approach the work. To give an example of this week where we've actually helped some families that are going to notary public. They're going alone as adults with another adult who's saying, if I get deported, will you take responsibility for my children? Well, they're doing that through a notary public in a legal way. As adults, do not bring the children there. Try to talk about these issues in a way that is supportive of kids.
Exactly.
And doesn't make them feel that they are exposed, because what kids will do is they'll say, I'm responsible, it's my fault. And so this is a very important piece of how we do our work and support with each other.
That is so important. Again, Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We only have a few more minutes together, and I wanted every week, and by the way, it really reminds me of the message that we got from Alice Walker, who's a fan of this show and this network, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, author of The Color Purple. And they put together, I think it was 10 or 15 things to do in the age of Trump. And, of course, at the top is be with friends, celebrate with music, be in nature, yeah. Make sure that... you know, right now, I don't even care where I am. When I'm walking down the street, I'm in front of the ocean. I'm inhaling and I'm exhaling.
That's right.
Because I want to stay alive. So, but you're working on a new album. Mm-hmm. We like to feature a song every week. So before we let you guys go, and we appreciate the company and the beautiful music, what do you have for us?
Thank you very much. It's a very simple song. And people can get more info there at rally.org/justicemusic, rally.org/
if people want to find out more about your music and your work.
Find out more,
yes,
about the music. And this is called We Are the Power. In the storm, we are the force beneath the ocean. We are the power. La 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 la, hey hi yo. La 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 la, hey hey. La 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 la. We are.
and feeble. We build up and we tear down. We hold a vision for the future that makes the world go round. En las guerras, pero la vida en el amor y en la paz. Hey, 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 oh, ay, la, 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 oh, ay, oh, ay, la, 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 hey, hey, la, 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 ay, la, 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 hey, ajá, la, 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 within the storm. We are the force beneath the ocean. We are the power. La, 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 la. We are the power. La, 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 la. We are the power.
Beautiful. Well, let me thank both of you for being here, for gracing us with the beautiful music, which keeps us going, which strengthens the spirit, and gives us information that sort of starts in the heart and works its way out to the rest of the body, and maybe something goes into the head, but we get to feel it as opposed to just sort of read it on a page, and it makes a big difference in our ability to continue. Music is really the blood of our spirit, right?
That's right. That's why we want folks to support, and KPFA, support KPFA. And we will see you tomorrow at 2969 Mission Street. People want more info, they can call 415-286-2452.
Give that number again.
415-286-2452. Tomorrow, Saturday, 6 p.m., May 13th. Lolo Cutumay. We also have the wonderful musicianship of Miguel Gobea and other poets and singers. Muchas gracias.
Can I make a request?
Yes, sir.
Do you remember? I'll just ask you to do one verse in English and one verse in Spanish. But do you remember when we interviewed Stanley Tookie Williams, mm-hmm. you know, days before he was executed by the state? And you did, at that time, you did this amazing spontaneous version of Redemption Song. Will you maybe you can do a verse, English, a verse in Espanol or something like that.
Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Have no fear of atomic energy, 'cause none of them gonna stop the time. How long will they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Ooh, some say it's just a part of it. We must fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption song, redemption song, redemption. Caminando por la calle, tú y yo, por las ciudades y los valles, haciendo revolución. canción. Caminando por los pueblos como fogón, trayendo esa calentura de amor al corazón. Won't you help to sing, yeah, these songs of freedom, 'cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption, we shall overcome. Roll the Union on, si se puede, redemption.
Thank you, Francisco. I needed to hear that one. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I thank my guests for coming in. Now I want to let you all know that you're about to listen to excerpts from a mighty powerful film about a subject that we know a lot about, racism in the South. But there's a new documentary that's extremely troubling and powerful called Spies in Mississippi. And it's deep background on the racist Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission. This was meant to foster extreme institutional discrimination against the black community of Mississippi and the South. And it was the precursor of the COINTELPRO program. So listen to this.
Down in Mississippi, way down.
Remember, Johnson said, there's America, there's the South, and then there's Mississippi.
Mississippi was a violent place in the 1950s and 1960s.
As far back as I can remember.
Any kind of civil rights agitation was a death-defying act.
The Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission was Mississippi's spy agency during the Civil Rights Movement.
And the Sovereignty Commission wanted to know who the activists were in the black community.
Down in Mississippi.
So they were out to stop overt efforts at integration.
Down in Mississippi, where I
state government itself. We're not just talking about some rednecks on the street or pulling this off. This is defined at its highest levels.
We knew we were being followed. I knew my life was in danger.
This is still the United States of America, and you don't treat American citizens this way.
You will be arrested for parading without a permit.
How far the Sovereignty Commission went in terms of crossing legal lines, I think it is accurate to say that they cross them all the time.
Way down in Mississippi. Down in Mississippi.
Looking at the United States, Mississippi is in the center of the state at the southernmost tip. Mississippi definitely is considered the Deep South. Growing up in Mississippi, I'm the youngest of 12 children. My parents were sharecroppers when I was born. So naturally, being a sharecropper, I did a lot of work in the fields. When I went to school, at that particular time, growing up, especially as black, the books we received and used were hand-me-down books once they became obsolete for the white students.
It was to keep that whole system that really had its roots in slavery. These are the people who cleaned their homes, worked their land. And if they could do more than that, they might actually become equal. And they never wanted it to come to a point where there would be real equality.
There was a higher percentage of African Americans living in Mississippi than in any other state. At one time, it was a majority. Those were the numbers that drove the intensity of the opposition to integration, that so many white people could not comprehend a reversal of the roles of whites and blacks. And they thought that blacks would dominate the state in almost every way. The political atmosphere in Mississippi in the middle 1950s was beginning to change very drastically.
By 1956, Brown versus Board of Education had been passed. The great Supreme Court ruling that said that you couldn't discriminate within education on the basis of race. The legislature of Mississippi was almost 100% segregationist. And many of them rabid segregationists at the time who felt that the struggle was starting to turn against the state and that the federal government was gaining power to enforce civil rights laws. And they create a special agency with the direct mission to preserve segregation.
In the legislature of 1956, one of the major bills that was passed during that session was a bill to create something called the Sovereignty Commission.
I'm sure that you will not fail to enact an appropriate state sovereignty bill, which will enable us during the next 2 years to maintain a successful fight for preserving the separation of the races in this state.
At that time, it seemed to be a harmless kind of legislation. It was more like a white chamber of commerce. Then we began to ask questions about it, about how that bill could be abused. It passed, however, and was enacted by the legislature and signed by Governor Coleman and set in motion.
This is Mississippi, the central state, the heart of the South.
It started out as a public relations campaign with films like Message for Mississippi, letting the world know that people liked the system of segregation in Mississippi and that nothing should ever change it.
Out of the statewide pattern of segregation, mutual respect and cooperation among the races, has arisen a productive, law-abiding way of life. Reverend J.W. Jones, colored pastor of New Albany and editor of a statewide colored newspaper, has this to say.
We have far less crime in our race in Mississippi in proportion to the population than in any state in the nation. I believe this is because of the way of life in Mississippi.
They sent out mailings, they sent out speakers, they invited newspaper people into the state, talked to them, tried to persuade them that, you know, all is well here. We got some good black people, and we treat them well.
The Sovereignty Commission became an instrument of state power in enforcing segregation.
It's initially a small agency under the control of the governor that will keep track of these civil rights organizations.
We were mounting what I think of as an earned insurgency in this country and in Mississippi. I think that earned for us the right to go to the rest of the country and say, we need the rest of the country to take a look at what's going on in Mississippi.
If you registered to vote, you immediately became an enemy of the state. If you rented from a white person, you were kicked out. If you worked for a white person, you were fired. And yet we got thousands of people to take on an entire state that was committed to an apartheid system that would make South Africa blush.
It was the beginning of the so-called civil rights era. That's when the tensions began to rise over what was coming, what people thought was coming down the road.
Within 3 to 4 years of its being formed, the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission transforms itself into a full-blown spy agency with a whole network of investigators and agents to go around the state exploring things that were going to possibly change what people euphemistically called the Mississippi way of life.
The Sovereignty Commission spy program actually started at a very small level. It's a couple of agents, usually former state police investigators, even former FBI agents, who are highly skilled investigators, and they're at the core. So they're investigating people believed to be connected to the NAACP. So these are people like Zach Van Landingham, a white agent trained in investigation, out there gathering information. The NAACP is the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and it's a historic organization. It was started in 1909. It was a biracial organization, so whites and blacks joining together to have a dedicated organization that would focus on advancing the rights of African Americans in the United States. I'll never forget finding the file on Clyde Kennard, the young man whose great crime against the state of Mississippi was to apply to go to college.
Clyde Kennard was a Korean War veteran, an upstanding citizen who had studied in the northern universities and who was very ambitious and a profoundly decent and good guy. In the 50s, Clyde Kennard tried to go to the University of Southern Mississippi.
In the 1950s, the few African Americans in the South who were able to enroll in college could only attend black schools. Kennard's application to attend Mississippi Southern was seen as an attack on segregation and set into motion a swift response from the state. His application was given to the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, an organization few Mississippians even knew existed. They did a report that tracked his background growing up in Mississippi, his time spent with his family in Chicago, his time in the military, his time at the University of Chicago, and his time back in Mississippi helping his ailing mother on her chicken farm. With multiple agents tracking everybody in his background, they couldn't come up with anything that could undercut his application to go to college.
The police, with the cooperation of the State Sovereignty Commission, planted stolen chicken feed from the county co-op, about $20 worth of chicken feed planted on his farm. He didn't steal them. Everybody knows that.
Now this, I wish that I could play more, because I wish you could have heard a little bit more about this documentary about the Sovereignty Commission. How many of you have ever heard about the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission? This extraordinary, call it sort of a combination of the Uptown Klan and Nazi op, that was really constructed to in every way, shape, and form repress black people, to undermine the civil rights movement, the burgeoning civil rights movement. It was designed in Mississippi. It was an extraordinary situation. People do not know a great deal about it. We have this documentary. And we also have a fund drive. Now, you can get any other premium or the T-shirts or the whatever. Today, we're making this available, but the other ones are available if you wanted to, the Vijay Prashad, or if you wanted the film in terms of John Pilger or whatever. It's all available. But you, I mean, you heard what we do. You know what we've been doing in terms of 15 years of reporting on what we consider the cutting edge of the civil rights movement. What is going to happen to between 10 and 12 million brown people, even as the United States turns brown? This is a story we have been so far ahead of the game. Now, Trump, he is dealing with a lot of crap in Washington, but he is creating great suffering for communities around this country that are dealing with the nature of documentation, forced relocation, because that's what happens. U.S. policy forces people off their land in Central America, then they end up here. We know, you all know, that's what's going on. Well, let me tell you something else that's going on, folks. This fund drive has fallen a bit behind. Seriously, has fallen a bit behind. And that, in the age of Trump, is a very bad sign. This institution, as far as I'm concerned, maybe you, if you agree with me, you'll call now, is more important than it has ever been, really, in its 68-year history. In the age of Trump, in the age of emerging sort of fascism in a Brooks Brothers suit. This radio station and this radio network, Pacifica. You know, you always have people trying to come in and steal the network. They got a better idea. But this beautiful, scrappy, fight back Pacifica Radio Network here, KPFA in the Bay Area, is an endangered species. It is the canary of the coal mine in terms of corporate information, fighting back against corporate lies. But we are here now. And we're going to have a lot of work ahead of us. And believe me, they are coming. They know we are here. We have to remain strong. We have to not leave any openings. We cannot, we have to make sure that we are strong at the roots, that the infrastructure is strong, and that we can keep this fight into the age of Trump. So again, I told you that we are, in fact, behind. We did get a nice $500 match. Thank you, Jennifer and Paul. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. There's a $500 match. You can get a copy of this documentary or anything else you've heard put out. But the documentary is called Spies of Mississippi. It's by Dawn Porter. It's a very powerful film with archival footage, very well done, about a history of a movement in terms of the Sovereignty Commission that we know very little about until this documentary came and brought us a good deal more about the role that this commission played in repressing the civil rights movement, even as it was emerging. And I can tell you that I've talked about this a little before, but I think it's relevant here. I can tell you that when I went back to Mississippi in 1995 and 96 to investigate over 100 church burnings in various southern states, the Klan had just created a major protest and burned a few crosses to celebrate, if you will, that finally in 1995 or 96 it was, the state of Mississippi was ratifying the anti-slave amendment of the United States Constitution. Can you imagine? When I got there, when I got to Mississippi to investigate these church burnings, a guy by the name of Larry Shoemake had just occupied a out-of-business fast food in downtown Jackson, and he had shot about a dozen people. I think he killed a couple of black people. And when they went back to his apartment, they found notes for a race war. And it really all dates back to the Sovereignty Commission and some of the stuff that was contrived there to repress, suppress, undermine. Really, it made South Africa apartheid look good, what they had in mind. That's what this documentary is about. You can get a copy for $120 contribution. That doubles to $240 because we've got a major match. But I'm being honest with you. We have a responsibility to do a little catch-up. I'm asking you to be generous. You have been generous many times over, my friends, my brothers and sisters here listening to Flashpoints, this endangered species, this investigative alternative news magazine. I'm asking you, I have 11 minutes left to raise $3,000. Really, we could do it in 4 minutes and then we could talk the rest of the time if you wanted to. If everybody calling now, if everybody listening now, dialed 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, We could do this in 5 minutes. I want to stand up for the people. I want to make sure that this radio station remains viable and strong and a scrappy fight-back institution that does speak truth to power and is effective in that regard. If you believe in investigative reporting, I'm not going off the top here. I'm not going to start raging at you. But I'm telling you that we are behind. And I'm going to hope that I can go into this weekend relaxing a little bit, knowing that the listeners of Flashpoints, the people who hear the work we've done in terms of what's happening now, dozens more being arrested by the new prison industry, the private prison industry. That's what we've been reporting about. That's what we care about. And there's so much more that we need to bring you on, so many different stories, but we need to do this work now. I will admit to you, I received once again one of those phone calls, and you get two frustrating kinds of phone calls that really blow my mind. One is, it's always, you know, if you would report, you know, more balanced about the situation in Israel and Palestine, I'd give thousands of dollars. You know, $10,000 tomorrow if you do, well, the balance is everybody else really tells the story lopsided and untruthful in terms of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. We do the other side, so we're definitely in the minority. So, you know, whatever. So that's frustrating. And the other thing that really hurts me is that I hear, and I understand it. When somebody will call up and say, you know what, I cannot stand to listen to you 30 seconds more. You're over the top, Bernstein. This rage, I don't know where it comes from, but it makes me nervous. And I don't think it's, you know, and people will say some fairly not nice things. And oftentimes, I can really understand. I don't want to offend anybody. And I do get intense. Miguel and I can get into it. But it's about belief. And it's being certain that this radio station, that non-corporate free speech over these powerful airwaves is quite crucial. And it really drives us to worry. What if we lose? What if we fail in our stewardship to pass this on to the next generation? What if we fail? We are the one remaining anti-corporate electronic canary in the coal mine. We're it. This electronic leaflet is an amazing experiment, 68 years old. Help us keep it going. I've got 8 minutes left. I haven't come close to my goal. But again, it would only take 3 or 4 minutes. If you want, just give us $25. 1-800-439-5732. Get a copy of Spies of Mississippi. For $120 contribution, you can get the T-shirts, the sweatshirts, the hoodies, the whatever. But I need you to stand up and make a big difference, because the real premium, what I want you to stand up for, what I want you to stand against passivity for, is the open flow of information, is our celebration, our 68-year celebration on Pacifica of the First Amendment. That is what I want to see. That's what we're here for. That's the work we have in front of us. Things are going slowly here at the Fund Drive, but let's pick it up. Let's see if the Flashpoints listeners can give us a nice boost into the weekend. How many of you, I would like to see how many of you can call at once. 1-800-439-5732. I once got about 12 people to call at once. We had maybe 14, 16 people calling at once with the switchboard and the overroll, the rollover of calls. You can do it on the web, by the way, at kpfa.org. Hit the pledge button, kpfa.org. Hit the pledge button, and you can subscribe there. 1-800-439-5732. This would also be a good day for a couple of you who have a little extra. This would be a good day, because this is a very, very slow moment, and this would be a boost into the weekend. So if you've got a little extra, give it a little extra. 500, 750, 1,000, 1500, this would be the day, this would be a very wonderful moment to make a difference in this fund drive. Can I ask you, can I urge you, can I encourage you? I'm sorry for those of you who feel it's an overreach, who feel that I get a little bit intense. I really don't want to insult you. I just want to keep the work going. Will you help us keep the work going? That's what I would like to do. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Won't you check us out right now? Won't you get active? Go from passive, letting the corporation sell you to products, to companies, to becoming a listener, an active listener supporter of free speech radio, celebrating the First Amendment. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, I need you to call now. We are a bit behind. I'm hoping we can pick it up in the last few minutes. It's a slow day. It's a slow week. It's a slow beginning. But we could have a fast ending to the week. We could have a rage of surging people who are in love with free speech who have decided just now. They heard something today, yesterday, this week, this month that made a difference, that changed the way they think, that changed something about their quality of their life. You got something very special from this radio station. And now you're going to stand up and you're going to put your money where your beliefs are. You're going to take an action that nobody can make you take. Usually you will do this alone. You will just simply dial or push the buttons, I should say, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. What is happening here, folks? We're going to need to make this moon. 1-800-439-5732. Not looking so good, folks. We got to move this along. All right, 1-800-439-5732. And please, if you will, I'd love you to call now. I'd love you to stand up for Free Speech Radio. I'd love you to do it in the context of investigative reporting here on Flashpoints. We are running out of time, and this could be, once again, I am worried this could be the lowest fundraising pitch I ever did in the history of my life if a few of you don't get up and call right now, unless these machines have broken down or something, and I doubt it. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Anybody got 25 or 2,500? We could use it right now. We could use you standing up and saying, I'm tired of being lied to by the corporate networks. I'm supporting Free Speech Radio because it does make a difference to me. That's what we want you to feel, say, and act upon. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Get a copy of the Spies of Mississippi. Any other thing that you've heard in terms of premiums you can get now. But what you really get again is the open flow of information. I've got 2 minutes left and I can't move this mic. I'm thinking maybe I'm talking to myself. Maybe can you hear me, Mike? Because maybe it's just me talking to myself. And oh, they're starting to ring. Oh my God. All right, we got 2 minutes to ring them off the hooks. Let's go, folks. They started. You're late, but you're here. Better late than never. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Let's ring them off the hooks. KPFA.org. KPFA.org. You can do that. We'll take it that way as well. 1-800-439-5732. 70 seconds. I'm hoping we can get a whole rush in these final 70 seconds to move things along. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We are down to the final 53 and a half seconds. 1-800-439-5732. How many of you can call in a half a second? At least half of you. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We are running out of time. We do have 29 seconds. 1-800-439-5732. If you all did it right now, if you picked up your cell phone right now and hit the buttons or went on the web right now, it would be incredible. You'd drive everybody nuts. 1-800-439-5732.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Since the 1970s, each year the United States has looked a little less like a democracy, a little more like a plutocracy. By now, it's looking very much like a plutocracy. Virtual Renderings has one of his engaging audio collages on the very subject. We broadcast it back in May 2011. I think it's time to hear it again. So here goes. Enjoy. Somewhere in North America lives a guy whose nom de guerre is Virtual Renderings, or sometimes Chaz K. Chaz K puts together marvelous audio collages, each on a certain theme. About 70 are available for free on the internet, and this show's webpage will give you a link to all of them, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Today we'll hear a recent collage of his called Peasant of the Dawn. I think it's one of his very best. It's about how class inequality and political inequality were engineered into the United States from the beginning. John Madison and other founders saw to that. It's about our current state of eternal warfare and how this helps the ruling elite to rule. It's about how greater equality of wealth would be quite easy to bring about, but doing so would threaten the class hierarchy. Having more than you could possibly eat is much more pleasant when you know that others are going hungry. You'll hear some familiar voices: Howard Zinn, Michael Parenti, Noam Chomsky, Roy Zimmerman, Harry Shearer, and even Ken Nordine, himself a master of the audio collage. The remarks on American exceptionalism and on the city on the hill are by historian Morris Berman, and much of the audio is from a reading of George Orwell's 1984. Orwell wrote that novel in the late 1940s, and it's stunning to see how well he could discern the shape of things to come. To make everything fit, I've cut back a little on some of the songs and other incidental stuff. Let's have a listen to Virtual Renderings' Peasant of the Dawn.
Thought crime.
Afghanistan, Indonesia.
Now, coming up tomorrow, we're going to make some changes. High's probably in the low 80s. There it is. And check this out. A cold front moving it.
What the?
The government's lying to you. They use religion to control the poor. Do you know that? I did. Well, bring more cops. What are you going to steal my sister away from me, too?
Would be kind of nice to be able to hear what goes on where you think what the little thoughts, notions,
thought crime.
The whims. The intuition. The vagrancies of your mind.
This notion of American exceptionalism is something that is so strong in our culture, in our education, that it constitutes sort of a fundamental lie that protects the actions of any administration from really, you know, close scrutiny.
Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past.
And then whatever common sense people have is somehow pushed to the side and is taken over by this kind of hysteria about terrorism, and therefore, well, anything we do that the president says against terrorism, I guess, is the right thing to do.
Fixation.
I'm not so sure anymore, you know?
Safety glass, no.
I mean, you think of something. Yeah.
I think there's an important connection, you know, between truth and democracy. You can't really think of your country as a democracy if people don't know the truth. And what we are misinformed about is not just the present, but the past. And that is especially important, because if you're lied to about the past, you're not really in a position to judge what you are told about the present. And anybody in authority can get up in front of the microphone and tell you that we must go to war for this reason or that reason.
I had an idea that nothing fails like success.
I had a similar thought.
You see someone who builds up an empire of their own.
That nothing succeeds like failure.
A few years later,
what happened?
Totally unknown.
And if you don't know any history, if you don't know anything about our past, you have no basis for challenging what you are being told. So we call ourselves a democracy, and we, you know, like to think that it's very simple. And there are the bad states, and there are the good states, and we're the good state. And, you know, that kind of sort of Manichaean division of the world into democracies and not democracies is very, very dangerous. Because then those countries which are designated as democracies think that they have a blank check to do whatever they want in the world, and it'll be okay.
We're never going to give in.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah. Thought crime.
Well, I think the founding myth involves things like American exceptionalism, that we were a people chosen by God for a certain type of experiment, that we would be a city on the hill, and that other countries would seek to emulate us and become like us, and that if they didn't, there was something wrong with them. I mean, they were obviously insane or savages or something like this.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night.
All people, all parties, all national leaders, all nations believe in their own virtue. But even more so, more than anything else in the world, more than all of these things I've been talking about, they believe with the utmost ferocity, with the utmost dedication, they believe in protecting and advancing their own interests. And they will kill to make sure those interests are advanced.
The men who got together in Philadelphia to frame the Constitution were financially successful planters, slaveholders, merchants, creditors, bankers, and manufacturers. Who else can take 4.5 months off to go sit in Philadelphia and write a constitution? Many of them were linked to each other by kinship and marriage, and by years of service in Congress or the military or diplomatic service.
The country was founded on the principle that there should be a democratic deficit. That's the Madisonian conception. You look back at the debates in the Constitutional Convention. Madison, of course, the main framer, he argued that, he didn't put it in these terms, but he argued basically that democracy is a bad thing. It's dangerous. We have to make sure that the public doesn't become involved in public affairs. So there should be a democratic deficit. America!
When the Founding Fathers, so-called Founding Fathers, met in Philadelphia, they were determined that persons of birth and fortune and affluence should control the affairs of the nation and check the what they call the leveling impulses of the propertyless multitude that composed the what Madison called a majority faction. James Madison, who played probably the most crucial role in the Constitution, putting the Constitution together, talked about how it was important in his famous Federalist Paper No. 10, how it was important to keep the spirit and form of popular government with only a minimum of the substance. How do you construct a government? And this was the task, he said, that the framers were facing. How do you construct a government that would win some popular support but would not tamper with the existing class structure? A government strong enough to service the growing needs of an entrepreneurial class while withstanding the democratic egalitarian demands of the popular class. And the way you do it is by excluding the popular class from most of the crucial points of power.
Offshore drilling is completely safe. You're getting sleepy. Tax cuts for the rich create new jobs. You're getting sleepy. Financial corporations will police themselves, and illegal aliens are stealing all your pens. Now when I count to three and snap my fingers, you'll awake refreshed and vote Republican.
Well, I tell you, from the outside, when you're looking at the U.S. from the outside, not only from Mexico, but from Europe, from England, whatever, it's a very, very peculiar country. And I've had the discussion with French and English and just other people that they just find it a most peculiar nation. And I personally think that's true. And to that peculiarity has been added the fact that we finally lost our way. I mean, I'm not sure we ever
snap
had it.
My fingers, you'll awake confused and vote Republican.
And among the American people, there grew the feeling that the revolution against the English crown had been fought for no good reason.
There still is a desire to save the country, to say that, well, if we do this and that, we will fix things. And my argument is, my friend, you're trying to turn around an aircraft carrier in a bathtub.
Yeah.
That cannot be done. 400 years of history cannot be reversed. We are who we are, and it didn't work out.
We've been warned against offering the people of this nation false hope. But
here's what I think is fair, that over the last 2 years, in an emergency situation, our basic attitude was, we've got to get some things done.
But
in order to do that, basically worked with the process as opposed to transform the process. And there's no doubt that that frustrated folks. But yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
But yes, we can. But yes, we can. But yes, we can. But it frustrates me. I think what I would say is,
yeah,
it's not going to happen overnight.
It's not going to happen overnight.
But Larry Summers did a heck of a job. Pun intended. But, you know, I'm
feeling great about where the American people are considering what we've gone through.
But
I mean, we've gone through the two toughest years of any time since the Great Depression. And in light of that, the fact that people have been resilient, that folks are still out there working and opening businesses, you know, working in the community, looking after their families, taking care of their responsibilities, that's encouraging. So there's still a lot of good stuff happening. But yes, we can.
But
yes, we can.
But
yes, we can.
But
yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
But people are frustrated. You know, people, a lot of folks are hurting out there still. And, you know, in that environment, I think that they're hoping that we can do a little bit better here in Washington than we've been doing.
But
yes, we can.
But
yes, we can.
But
yes, we can.
But
yes, we can.
But.
What kind of people would control this world has been equally obvious. The new aristocracy was made up for the most part of bureaucrats, scientists, technicians, trade union organizers, publicity experts, sociologists, teachers, journalists, and professional politicians. These people, whose origins lay in the salaried middle class and the upper grades of the working class, had been shaped and brought together by the barren world of monopoly industry and centralized government. As compared with their opposite numbers in past ages, they were less avaricious, less tempted by luxury, hungrier for pure power, and above all, more conscious of what they were doing and more intent on crushing opposition. This last difference was cardinal. By comparison with that existing today, all the tyrannies of the past were half-hearted and inefficient. The ruling groups were always infected to some extent by liberal ideas and were content to leave loose ends everywhere, to regard only the overt act, and to be uninterested in what their subjects were thinking. In the past, no government had the power to keep its citizens under constant surveillance. The invention of print, however, made it easier to manipulate public opinion, and the film and the radio carried the process further. With the development of television and the technical advance which made it possible to receive and transmit simultaneously on the same instrument, private life came to an end. The possibility of enforcing not only complete obedience to the will of the state, but complete uniformity of opinion on all subjects now existed for the first time.
Welcome to Intermission.
And if you were wondering what the heck you're listening to, this is the audio collage, Peasant of the Dawn, by Virtual Renderings, rebroadcast on New World Notes. Why? Because we like you. Yes, that previous song, Yes We Can, But, was a duet featuring Harry Shearer and Barack H. Obama. This collage is all about hierarchy, social control, political control, and the subversion of democracy, with an increasing portion of the audio a reading of George Orwell's great 1984. On we go.
From the moment when the machine first made its appearance, it was clear to all thinking people that the need for human drudgery, and therefore to a great extent for human inequality, had disappeared. If the machine were used deliberately for that end, hunger, overwork, dirt, illiteracy, and disease could be eliminated within a few generations. And, in fact, without being used for any such purpose but by a sort of automatic process, by producing wealth which it was sometimes impossible not to distribute, the machine did raise the living standards of the average human being very greatly over a period of about 50 years at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries.
It's kind of ironic. Technology's progressed so far now, we don't even know what's real and what's an idea anymore.
But it was also clear that an all-round increase in wealth threatened the destruction, indeed in some sense was the destruction, of a hierarchical society. In a world in which everyone worked short hours, had enough to eat, lived in a house with a bathroom and a refrigerator, and possessed a motor car or even an airplane, the most obvious and perhaps the most important form of inequality would already have disappeared. If it once became general, wealth would confer no distinction. It was possible, no doubt, to imagine a society in which wealth, in the sense of personal possessions and luxury, should be evenly distributed, while power remained in the hands of a small privileged caste. But in practice, such a society could not long remain stable. For if leisure and security were enjoyed by all alike, the great mass of human beings who are normally stupefied by poverty would become literate and would learn to think for themselves. And when once they had done this, they would sooner or later realize that the privileged minority had no function, and they would sweep it away.
Let us all agree. Let us not dissent. Let us not ask questions such as where our freedoms went. We'll just fly, fly the flag, sing God Bless America. Question people's patriotism who don't join in the hysteria.
Physical rebellion, or any preliminary move toward rebellion, is at present not possible. From the proletarians, nothing is to be feared. Left to themselves, they will continue from generation to generation and from century to century, working, breeding, and dying, not only without any impulse to rebel, but without the power of grasping that the world could be other than it is. They could only become dangerous if the advance of industrial technique made it necessary to educate them more highly. But since military and commercial rivalry are no longer important, the level of popular education is actually declining. What opinions the masses hold or do not hold is looked on as a matter of indifference. They can be granted intellectual liberty because they have no intellect. War, it will be seen, not only accomplishes the necessary destruction, but accomplishes it in a psychologically acceptable way. In principle, it would be quite simple to waste the surplus labor of the world by building temples and pyramids, by digging holes and filling them up again, or even by producing vast quantities of goods and then setting fire to them. But this would provide only the economic and not the emotional basis for a hierarchical society. What is concerned here is not the morale of the masses, whose attitude is unimportant so long as they are kept steadily at work, but the morale of the party itself. Even the humblest party member is expected to be competent, industrious, and even intelligent within narrow limits. But it is also necessary that he should be a credulous and ignorant fanatic, whose prevailing moods are fear, hatred, adulation, and orgiastic triumph. In other words, it is necessary that he should have the mentality appropriate to a state of war. It does not matter whether the war is actually happening. And since no decisive victory is possible, it does not matter whether the war is going well or badly. All that is needed is that a state of war should exist. The splitting of the intelligence which the party requires of its members, and which is more easily achieved in an atmosphere of war, is now almost universal. But the higher up the ranks one goes, the more marked it becomes. It is precisely in the inner party that war hysteria and hatred of the enemy are strongest. In his capacity as an administrator, it is often necessary for a member of the inner party to know that this or that item of war news is untruthful, and he may often be aware that the entire war is spurious and is either not happening or is being waged for purposes quite other than the declared ones. But such knowledge is easily neutralized by the technique of doublethink. Meanwhile, no inner party member wavers for an instant in his mystical belief that the war is real, and that it is bound to end victoriously.
I'm getting old, my son, my days are nearly done. And I won't leave this world with nothing left undone. But my time is running fast. With each breath that may be my last. So I'll give to you now the gift my father he once passed. Well, the peasants of the peace, the peasants of the dawn. Yeah, the love becomes priceless when the money's all gone. Peasants of the dawn. Well, the plan for us is global, some would say ignoble. But the world's judgment moves us not at all. Here, for centuries we've created the world we favor. Where our rule is total and the population small. Well, they're peasants of the peace, they're just peasants of the dawn. Yes, their love becomes priceless when the money's all gone. Peasants of the dawn. We, the new aristocrats, have no need of teeming peasant brats. They add nothing to the mix, use our oil by the vats. For the calling is beginning, our heady plans are spinning. Generations underground, and we rebuild the world we've so carefully despoiled. So my son, take our message to the lowly, useless eaters of the globe. We, the masters of the world, need only wait a few more years, and then there will be none to carp or criticize or peer into our rule. Those alive will be our abject slaves, you among the masters, reigning evermore through all the coming years. Through all the coming years. They're just peasants of the peace, they're peasants of the dawn. Love becomes priceless when the money's all gone. Peasants of the dawn.
He had committed the essential crime that contained all others in itself. Thought crime, they called it. Thought crime was not a thing that could be concealed forever. You might dodge successfully for a while, even for years, but sooner or later they were bound to get you. It was always at night. The arrests invariably happened at night. The sudden jerk out of sleep, the rough hand shaking your shoulder, the lights glaring in your eyes, the ring of hard faces round the bed. In the vast majority of cases, there was no trial, no report of the arrest. People simply disappeared, always during the night. Your name was removed from the register. Every record of everything you had ever done was wiped out. Your one-time existence was denied and then forgotten. You were abolished, annihilated, vaporized was the usual word.
This show ain't no good.
No?
And unfortunately, you and I have run out of time. They're coming for you, and I don't know what they're going to do.
Can you hear me? Stay calm. Everything will be all right. The door seems to be jammed. Please check the lock on your side.
Everything will be all right. We are here to help you. Stay calm. Everything will be all right.
And with those words from Orwell's 1984 ends Virtual Rendering's most excellent sound collage, Peasant of the Dawn. New World Notes comes to you from the East of the River Satellite Studios and Skunk Works of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. Thanks to Virtual Renderings, Chaz K. for his great work. Thanks to you for listening. Illegitimi non carborundum. Keep trying to live each day as though the truth were true, and hope to see you again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. April 19th, 2017 marks the 22nd anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing of the Murrow Building. The show you're about to hear was originally recorded and aired in April of 2015 on the 20th anniversary. So when you hear those references to the 20th anniversary, please know that we're now at the 22nd anniversary. So let's begin. April 19th marked the 20th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing of the Alfred P. Murrow Building in 1995, which killed 168 people, including 19 children. Timothy McVeigh was accused of the crime and was allegedly executed in June of 2001, just months before 9/11. His bomb-making accomplice, Terry McNichols, is serving a life sentence without parole. On today's show, we'll look at some of the evidence that challenges the official story of what happened in Oklahoma City that day. I'm sure you'll see similarities to 9/11. And like 9/11, there are mountains of evidence showing that we've been lied to and that there's a cover-up going on. Now, if you're one of those people who thinks I'm a crazy conspiracy theorist, I ask you to investigate Oklahoma City and 9/11 for yourself before you condemn me. I believed the official story of Oklahoma City until roughly 2009, and I really didn't want to believe the new evidence that I was getting. And my first thought was, oh my God, not Oklahoma City too. But I did some research and watched the video, A Noble Lie, and I had to accept the facts before me, and they didn't support the official story. We showed the film A Noble Lie a few years ago at the University of Hartford. But if you didn't get to see it, it's now posted on YouTube, so you can watch it at any time and for free. I'm going to start off today by reading an article by chemist, author, and blogger Kevin Ryan. And the article's called 20 Years Later, Facts About the Oklahoma City Bombing That Go Unreported, which was posted on April 12, 2015 on his website, digwithin.net. And here goes. Next week will mark the 20th anniversary of the terrorist bombing of the Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma City, which killed 168 people, including 19 children. The mainstream media will undoubtedly focus its attention on Timothy McVeigh, who was put to death in June of 2001 for his part in the crime. They might also mention Terry Nichols, who was convicted of helping McVeigh plan the bombing and is serving a life sentence without parole. There will be less discussion about how the FBI spent years hunting for a man who witnesses say accompanied McVeigh on the day of the bombing. They called this accomplice John Doe Number 2, and theories about his identity range from an Iraqi named Hussein al-Husani to a German national described below to a neo-Nazi bank robber named Richard Guthrie. And remember that name, it comes up later in the show. So Richard Guthrie. The Justice Department finally gave up its search and said it was all a mistake, that there was never any credible evidence of a John Doe Number 2 being involved. That reversal demonstrates a pattern of cover-up by authorities and limited media coverage in the years since the crime. This week, accounts will not repeat any reports of secondary devices in the building or reports of the involvement of unknown Middle Eastern characters. There will also be little, if any, mention of the extensive independent investigation into the crime that was conducted by leading members of the Oklahoma City community. Here are seven more facts that will probably not see much coverage on the 20th anniversary. And before getting to those seven facts,
I just wanted to state that there are many eyewitnesses to the Oklahoma City bombing that said that there were secondary explosions and other bombs were found within the building. And there are experts who say that the bomb in the Ryder truck could not have been responsible for the size of the explosion in the building. See any similarities to 9/11, like the unacknowledged explosions, ignoring eyewitnesses to the secondary explosions, and there's more. But now back to the article written by Kevin Ryan and the 7 points, which you're not going to see much coverage about in the media on this 20th anniversary. Number one, attorney Jesse Trentadue began investigating the case after his brother Kenny was killed in prison, apparently having been tortured to death by the FBI in its search for John Doe number two. Trentadue's investigation led to a federal judge nearly finding the FBI in contempt of court for tampering with a key witness. Trentadue now says, quote, "There's no doubt in my mind, and it's proven beyond any doubt that the FBI knew that the bombing was going to take place months before it happened, and they didn't stop it." Number two, Judge Clark Wadoops, who presided over the case brought by Jesse Trentadue, ruled in 2010 that CIA documents associated with the case must be held secret. These documents show that the CIA was involved in the Oklahoma City bombing investigation and the prosecution of McVeigh. This means that foreign parties were involved because the CIA is prohibited from interfering in purely domestic investigations. Number three, Andreas Strassmeier, a former German military officer, was suspected of being John Doe number two. Strassmeier became close friends with McVeigh, and they were both associated with a neo-Nazi organization located in Elohim City, Oklahoma. A retired U.S. intelligence official claimed that Strassmeier was working for the German government and the FBI while at Elohim City. Mainstream reports about the Oklahoma City bombing typically avoid reference to Strassmeier. Fact number four, Larry Potts was the FBI supervisor who was responsible for the tragedies at Ruby Ridge in 1992 and in Waco in 1993. Potts was then given responsibility for investigating the Oklahoma City bombing. Terry Nichols claimed that McVeigh, who allegedly had been recruited as an undercover intelligence asset while in the Army, had been working under the supervision of Potts. Fact number five, Terry Yeakey, an officer of the Oklahoma City Police Department, was among the first to reach the scene, and he was heralded as a hero for rescuing many victims. Yeakey was also an eyewitness to conversations and physical evidence that convinced him that there was a cover-up of the bombing by federal agents. Yeakey was committed to getting to the truth about what happened, but a year after the bombing, he was found dead off the side of a rural road. His death was filed a suicide, despite overwhelming evidence that he was murdered. Authorities reported that Yeakey slit his wrists and neck, then miraculously climbed over a barbed wire fence, walked over a mile's distance through a nearby field, and eventually shot himself in the side of the head at an unusual angle. No weapon was found, no investigation was conducted, no fingerprints were taken, and no interviews were conducted. His family continues to fight for the truth about his death. Number six, Gene Corley, the engineer who was hired by the government to support his claims about the structural fire at the Branch Davidian complex in Waco, was brought in to investigate the destruction of the Murrow Building. Corley brought along three other engineers, Charles Thornton, Meet Sozin, and Paul Malachar. Their investigation was conducted from half a block away where they could not observe any of the damage directly, yet their conclusions supported the pre-existing official account. A few years later, within 72 hours of the 9/11 attacks, these same four men were on the site leading the investigation at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Fact number seven, there are many other links between Oklahoma City and 9/11. For example, the alleged hijackers visited the Oklahoma City area many times and even stayed at the same hotel that was frequented by McVeigh and Nichols. After both the Oklahoma City bombing and 9/11, building monitoring hotel videos went missing. FBI harassment of witnesses was seen, and officials ignored evidence that did not support the political story. Additionally, numerous oddities link the Oklahoma City area to Al-Qaeda. In 2002, Oklahoma City resident Nick Berg was interrogated by the FBI for lending his laptop and internet password to alleged 20th hijacker Zacharias Moussaoui. 2 years after his interrogation, Berg became world famous as a victim of beheading in Iraq. Investigators looking for clues about these connections will be particularly interested in two airports, the president of the University of Oklahoma, and the CIA leader who both monitored the alleged hijackers in Germany and was hired at the university just before 9/11. On April 19, 2015, at the 20th anniversary of one of the worst terrorist attacks in history, citizens should be reminded that we don't know what happened that day. We don't know because officials have covered up the crime for unknown reasons, and most media sources will not challenge that cover-up. And I want to encourage people to go to Kevin Ryan's website, Dig Within, and read this article for yourself if you would like more information, because he's got a lot of links there embedded within the article to take you to sites that explore the issues and those seven facts in more detail. And now you're going to hear parts of an audio clip from a 2011 Alex Jones interview with attorney Jesse Trentadue. You can hear the full interview by going to YouTube and searching for Alex Jones and Oklahoma City. So let's begin with attorney Jesse Trentadue discussing how he got involved in investigating the Oklahoma City bombings.
And it started with the murder of my brother. My brother was picked up for a so-called parole violation in Southern California, sent immediately to Oklahoma City. 2 days later, the federal government said he committed suicide and they tried to have his body cremated. We fought very hard to get his body returned to us. His throat was cut. They said he'd hanged himself. His throat was cut. His head was smashed open to three places. He'd been beaten head to toe, front to back. Even the soles of his feet had been beaten. We never had a motive for why they killed him. And then shortly before he was executed, I get a message from Tim McVeigh that said, when I saw your brother's picture and heard what happened to him, I wanted you to know that he was killed by the FBI. They mistook him for Richard Lee Guthrie. And Guthrie was the person I believe is John Doe 2. Guthrie, about a year after my brother's murder, ended up supposedly hanging himself while in the custody of the FBI. And we had a witness to my brother's murder, and a month before we went to trial, they found him hanging in his cell while under federal custody. But to cut to the core of it, apparently my brother matched Richard Lee Guthrie in the description that the FBI was circulating for John Doe 2. It was a white male, 5'9", powerful upper body build, dark complected, believed to be in Canada or Mexico, driving 1986 Chevrolet pickup truck and a dragon tattoo on his left forearm. That was a perfect match for my brother. He was coming back across the border in San Diego, been down into Mexico. He was driving his friend's 1986 Chevrolet pickup truck. He was 5'9", powerful upper body build, dark complected, dragon tattoo left forearm. Stopped, arrested, sent to Oklahoma and dead 2 days later. Once I knew that, I started to try to find some link between Guthrie, who was even looked like my brother, and the Oklahoma City bombing. And I didn't start out to solve the Oklahoma City bombing. I started out to find out who killed my brother and why. But everything I did took me to Oklahoma City and the bombing. Well, I started to sue the government under the Freedom of Information Act to get records. And among the first records I got were a series of teletypes from FBI Director Louis Free to FBI offices in Oklahoma and around certain locations around the country, talking about McVeigh had called Ellingham City 2 days before the bombing and had asked for more help. And an informant had intercepted that call and advised the FBI. I had documents that showed that a government informant had actually gone to Oklahoma City with McVeigh and scouted the target 4 months before the bombing. And I sued for records involving the CIA. And the CIA shouldn't be involved in the Oklahoma City bombing case because it is a foreign intelligence service and it's illegal for it to be operating in the United States. And for the first time, they came back and the CIA claimed national security. They said it would be a grave threat to the national security of the United States if they release the records. And that's one of the exemptions the government has, that they don't have to turn over anything, is if it would jeopardize national security. But I'm thinking, what in the world is the CIA doing looking at this white supremacist camp in Oklahoma City?
And this next clip is Attorney Jesse Trentadue's response to Alex Jones's question about what he thinks really happened based on all the evidence he's uncovered.
I think it's now apparent that it was some kind of government operation. Whether McVeigh was actually working for the government originally and then went rogue on him, or whether it was planned all along, I don't know. But the FBI had at least four or five informants involved with this operation. They knew in advance it was going to happen. And once it happened, they did everything in the world they could to cover it up. I sued to get the surveillance tapes from around on the Murrow building. The surveillance cameras actually on a building that was destroyed, and the surveillance cameras tapes on the roads leading up to the building. I get all the tapes except the one for the Murrow building. But the tapes they give me go blank at various times between 8:54 and 9:02 when the bomb went off. So I have six or seven different buildings where when a vehicle would be passing, specifically the bomb truck and with the Ryder truck, the tape goes blank. And you know, further up the road, a little later, that tape goes blank. So in essence, 26 tapes that I received go blank at various times between 8:54 and 9:02 on April 19, 1995. And the government of the United States says, well, that's because the tapes were being changed.
What he means here is that the government claims that the tapes at these various locations were all being changed to new tapes all at the same time that morning, conveniently, when the truck with the bomb was driving by.
That's basically what they said. But more importantly, they don't give me the tapes from the Murrow building. And I had been leaked the Secret Service timeline that said surveillance cameras showed the bomb detonating 3 minutes and 6 seconds after the suspect exited the vehicle. Now, that was the Murrow building camera tapes. I've sued to get those. No one has ever seen those outside of the FBI, to my knowledge.
And an FBI agent told the Washington Times and L.A. Times he's seen them, and it shows McVeigh with other people.
Yes, and the government, the FBI specifically says they can't find. Now, the most important evidence, you would think, that would have been Exhibit 1 in the prosecution of Tim McVeigh, a tape showing him driving the truck up to the building, setting the timer, getting out of the truck, walking away, and the bomb going off. They didn't use that tape. The reason they didn't use it is because it has other people getting out of that truck, one or more of whom was probably an informant.
The Alex Jones interview with Jesse Trentadue is in four parts on YouTube. What you just heard is the tip of the iceberg. So if you want to learn more about what really happened at Oklahoma City, you can continue your research there. And again, once you're on YouTube, search for Alex Jones and Oklahoma City. And now you're going to hear parts of an interview with Alex Jones and the two producers of the film A Noble Lie, which I mentioned earlier. So here's James Lane and Holland Vanden Nieuwenhoff discussing the evidence from their film.
Well, what we can demonstrate is that the Ryder truck bomb, for one, was not the sole cause of destruction to the Murrah building, that there were other people also involved who assisted McVeigh, and these people were ignored by the U.S. government, that some of these people were U.S. government informants. We have the paper and named them by name. We named some of the agents involved. We named some of the government figures involved. Terry Nichols, in prison, gave an affidavit, and he has nothing to gain by lying about his role. He is suffering under two life sentences. He's never leaving jail. He named Larry Potts. Tim McVeigh had told him that Larry Potts, assistant director of the FBI, was in charge of the operation that culminated in the Oklahoma City bombing. Louis Free, head of the FBI, is now retired and now in charge of the Penn State investigation, the child abuse scandal going on there, so we can be assured that truth and justice will not be achieved in that matter, as it was not achieved in Oklahoma City. The victims here, we were lied to about every aspect of the bombing, top to bottom. What is amazing is that they were able to get away with it, and that the mainstream media did not cover all of these points in a cohesive package. The American people can see it and say that this is a lie, and why is it happening? This can all be erased. All our doubts erased by releasing the security videotapes that surround the Murrah building that showed exactly what happened. Who drove that truck? What exactly happened at the building? 16 years later, they say they don't have them or they're lost, or that the tapes they have released, they're all having their tapes changed at the same time, 9:02 a.m., which is ridiculous. The official story and its excuses are very implausible. And if they, once the American people see this, they'll come to understand the true nature of terrorism and question everything that their government says from now on.
Absolutely. And then they say that the primary explosive was ammonium nitrate and fuel oil that was in the Ryder truck that day. We've got eyewitness testimony from the survivors of that building. I mean, who are you going to believe? The people that were actually there or the people that are trying to push the official story? They said that the building was coming down 8 to 10 seconds before the truck bomb went off. They thought it was an earthquake. They had enough time to get under their desk before the glass blew in. According to the FEMA report, that blast wave from the truck was moving at 1,300 feet per second. The story just doesn't hold water, according to the people that were actually there. When you add that with the fact that we've got Brigadier General Parton, who does an analysis of the bombing showing where the additional ordnance would have been placed. You've got Dr. Samuel Cohen, the inventor of the neutron bomb, saying that it would be against the laws of physics, no matter how much ammonium nitrate and fuel oil was used, to bring that building down. We've got a report from Eglin Air Force Base where they constructed a single larger explosive, set it off next to a weaker structure, and it did less damage. It was their conclusion that there had to be additional ordnance inside the building. We've got Officer Terrence Shaky, real hero that day, saved 8 people's lives, but he was on the scene within minutes. One of the hallmarks of an ammonium nitrate and fuel oil bomb is a nitric gas cloud. The first 26 responders were hospitalized from the inhalation of nitric gas. That did not happen. And Terry Yakey saving people from the building that day within minutes proves that there was no nitric gas cloud.
And speaking next is Alex Jones.
All right, I want to add a key piece of evidence here. And not one, not two, but 3 different high-level FBI agents, including Larry Potts, the deputy director, head of counterterrorism, said he was in Dallas, took a Southwest Airlines flight. Even mainstream media said there were no flights going in that day at that time. Then he said, oh, I drove. Hotel receipts of him the day before, which people knew to look into because he'd been seen. So right there, we know they're on the ground. It fits into what McVeigh and others had said. They needed to go after the states' rights movement that was centered around Oklahoma. They needed to demonize the growing militia movement. They needed to kind of cover up what had happened at Waco with the FLIR footage and the killing there that was coming out in Congress right at that time. Bill Clinton told USA Today on Air Force One right after being elected, he said, I owe my reelection to Oklahoma City. And to Eric Holder, who was involved in the cover-up, we've got his emails, thanks to the lawsuits with Jesse Trinidad and others, getting the information through FOIA. But we have Holder running a false flag with tens of thousands of guns into Mexico and drugs back into the U.S. That's now all confirmed. We knew it back in January of this year. I mean, this is big medicine. This is big news. And then the memos, ABC, CBS got them, where they said, we're going to do this to blame the Second Amendment. There's a false flag confirmed.
Exactly. Operation Fast and Furious is making the headlines right now, where it shows that the ATF is documented, along with the FBI, was shipping guns to Mexico. That has killed thousands of people. And Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, responsible for enforcing the laws of the land back in 1995, he was in charge of the FBI investigation, the Department of Justice investigation into the Oklahoma City bombing, and in charge of the cover-up of the murder of Kenneth Trentadue in federal custody. We have his emails where he talks about the Trentadues and Trentadon'ts on how to cover up the story. And the Trentadue story led directly to Oklahoma City. So what you have in the headlines now is Holder implicated right now in a false flag operation that has killed thousands of people. So we have him implicated in what is now being reported in the mainstream media as legitimately a false flag operation. Holder, back in 1995, was in charge of another false flag operation, the Oklahoma City bombing. This is why this movie is so timely. We're showing that it's a continual pattern, and if these people are not held accountable for their crimes, they rise up in power and they commit even greater crimes. And what we can conclusively prove with this movie, at the very least, is that the official story is a lie.
What this movie does is it shows the methodology of state-sponsored terror. At the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, there was a patriot movement in this country. People were talking about a restoration of the Constitution, the expansion of the police state powers. They were resisting the anti-terrorism legislation that was trying to be passed. After the Oklahoma City bombing, it completely silenced anybody that opposed the globalization agenda. And then about the time the patriot movement started to get renewed, we had 9/11. Oklahoma City was a precursor to 9/11. I mean, after the event, the Patriot Act passed. Everybody was begging to have their freedoms taken away. Prior to 9/11, they never would have accepted it. And now we have a new patriot movement moving in this country, and exposing these events is going to take away their false flag power.
Some of these facts are just so amazing that they would even pass the plausibility test in a fiction story. We have the brother of the Oklahoma governor at the time of the bombing, Frank Keating, his brother Martin Keating, who is a self-admitted insider in military intelligence, writes a book called Final Jihad. According to the publisher, this book was written in 1992. This is about the time, mind you, that McVeigh was being recruited for secret government activities out of the Army, according to his own admission. Martin Keating writes a book called Final Jihad, which features a character named Ted McVeigh, who tries to bomb a federal building in Oklahoma City, a plot that is foiled by a state trooper. Now we take that fiction, that so-called fiction, we look at the reality that was presented to us the day of the bombing, is that McVeigh gets arrested after the bombing in Oklahoma by a state trooper. Now, this obviously is not a coincidence, and then no one can defend that. Obviously, there was inside knowledge on the part of the governor's office.
And again, you were just listening to part of an interview with Alex Jones and James Lane and Holland van den Nieuwenhoff discussing the evidence presented in their film, A Noble Lie, which is now posted on YouTube. It's 2 hours long. And I'm going to end the show today with the audio from a video put together by James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com. It's been slightly edited to allow for the difference between video and audio. When you hear it, you may remember the five-minute video he did about 9/11 a few years back. There are many similarities between the two events. So here it is, Everything You Need to Know About the Oklahoma City Bombing by James Corbett.
On the morning of April 19, 1995, a decorated Gulf War combat vet blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City using a truck bomb that he didn't build and a Ryder truck that he didn't rent with the help of a passenger who didn't exist. Having just gotten away with the largest act of terrorism on U.S. soil to date, the Fort Bragg-trained Special Forces Sheep Drip dropout blended in with the crowd by making his getaway in a car without a license plate and was immediately pulled over. The ATF was the supposed target of the attack, but luckily all of their agents were out of the office that morning. Later that day, the president boldly declared,
"We will find the people who did this."
And
when we do, justice will be swift, certain, and severe.
Except for
John Doe number two.
John Doe number two.
John Doe number two.
Who, according to the FBI, never existed. In McVeigh's unprecedented 3.5-week trial, the prosecution didn't show the CCTV footage of him and John Doe number two parking the Ryder truck. Didn't explain why 24 separate witnesses mass hallucinated the existence of John Doe number two. Didn't explain why the government was testing truck bombs and the Army was storing Ryder trucks at Camp Gruber right before the bombing, and didn't talk to the FBI informants who blew the whistle on the plot. But they did collaborate with the CIA, and they did convict McVeigh as the lone wolf bomber and Terry Nichols as his bomb-constructing accomplice. Still, a bunch of crazy conspiracy theorists, including 300 bombing victims, insist on talking about facts and evidence and refuse to simply believe what they've been told a million times by people in tailored suits with well-coiffed hair. They quote the U.S. Army Brigadier General and the FBI crime lab whistleblower and the inventor of the neutron bomb who point out the physical impossibility that the Ryder truck bomb did the damage to the building, but that doesn't matter because if there were other bombs in the building that day, we would have heard about them.
The second explosive was found and defused.
I think he said another bomb.
The Justice Department is reporting that a second explosive device has been found.
They then found a third device, which was also larger than the first.
And I see another bomb truck going, so apparently they're going to try to get out that third bomb.
The FBI claims to have lost the footage showing McVeigh and John Doe number two parking the truck in front of the Murrah building that morning, but that's understandable because the Bureau has a lot of important evidence to store. Terry Nichols insists the FBI was involved in the plot, but thankfully a judge has saved us the trouble of listening to him by preventing lawyers from deposing him. There was a bomb squad truck parked across the street 2 hours before the blast, but that just shows the authorities were prepared for anything. And
other documents obtained by 2020 show that someone called the Executive Secretariat's office at the Justice Department in Washington and said the Morrow building had been bombed. But this was 24 minutes before the blast.
But that just shows the public was unusually vigilant that morning. Also,
apparently, before the bombing, Governor Frank Keating's brother, Mark, had been working on a novel about a terrorist bombing in Oklahoma City. Stranger still, one of the characters in the novel was named Thomas McVeigh.
But that's probably just a coincidence. McVeigh wrote a letter to his sister where he admitted to being a secret special forces operative and he complained to friends of the pain in his from an army-implanted microchip, but that's crazy because if he didn't actually leave the army in 1991, there would be proof of that. McVeigh was not executed on May 16th, 2001 as scheduled because
The FBI had failed to turn over thousands of pages of evidence to McVeigh's defense attorneys.
But the execution went ahead on June 11th. In a highly unusual and secret agreement, no autopsy was performed. One witness said he was still breathing, and the prison officials admitted his hearse was a decoy. Then, the case was officially closed. And if you question any part of this story, you are a paranoid wingnut birther truther tenther prepper conspiracy loon who should feel guilty for having been born. If you love baseball, fluffy kittens, hot dogs, Barbie, Star Wars, and freedom, you will never ever bring up any of these points ever again. Ever. This message has been brought to you by the friends of the FBI, ATF, DOJ, CIA, SPLC, MSM, and the U.S. Army. And remember, ignorance is strength.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
I watched Carol Burnett and Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin, and I just wanted to be like them. And I didn't realize that I was going to dress up like a woman and kind of be like them, but they made me feel all warm and fuzzy inside. When I learned about gender fluidity, as soon as I heard that description, I'm like, oh my God, that's me.
That's me, yeah. Do you miss when drag was underground?
No, because I make more money.
March, march, sweep you along.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Putin promises to probe Chechnya's gay purge, singing the praises of a queer composer and suffragist, and revealing the secrets of Pandora Box. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending May 6th, 2017. There was some relatively hopeful news this week about the horrifying attempt by officials in the mostly Muslim Russian region of Chechnya to exterminate gay and bisexual men, or those perceived to be. At last count, more than 300 men had been rounded up and placed in one of at least six gay concentration camps, where they're beaten, starved, and shocked in homemade electric chairs until they provide the names of all their gay friends. Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov has boasted to reporters that the region will be free of homosexuals before Ramadan begins at the end of May. The independent Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta, which first broke the story, reports that at least 30 men have now died, some during torture and others at the hands of their own families. Chechen police are telling Muslim families with gay children to murder them before the authorities do it for them. Honor killings by relatives of those who shame their families are not uncommon.
Svetlana Zakharova is with the Russian LGBT Network. She assessed the situation during a recent interview on the Turkish Radio and Television Corporation program, TRT World.
Russia is a homophobic country, but we have never seen such a level of violence. We have never heard about such a massive campaign about any group of people in the modern Russia. So what's going on in Chechnya right now is just unprecedented.
Chechnya is a mostly autonomous region of Russia with its own government and court system, but it's still part of the Russian Federation. President Vladimir Putin had dismissed the allegations about what the government of his good friend, Ramzan Kadyrov, was doing. But there was word late this week that Putin has finally agreed to an official investigation into what he called the well-known information or rumors about what is happening to men in Chechnya with a non-traditional sexual orientation. The announcement came soon after German Chancellor Angela Merkel reportedly confronted Putin on the issue during a rare visit to Moscow earlier this week. Once again, Svetlana Zakharova.
First 2 weeks, the federal authorities were absolutely silent about this situation, and they didn't talk about it despite all the international pressure. They kind of pretended that it's not happening in Russia. But now they started to do something, and at first the prosecutor's office of Chechnya stated that they are going to open the investigation, and then we have information that the Federal Investigative Committee started to do something. So there is still hope that, like, all the responsible sites will be punished. it's not just about discrimination of homosexual people. It's about people being tortured and killed.
It remains to be seen whether this is nothing more than an attempt to pacify overwhelming world criticism or if genuine efforts will be made to stop Chechnya's anti-gay genocide.
In another of the world's homophobic hotspots, Indonesia, as many as 14 men were arrested on April 30th during raids of parties in two hotel rooms in Surabaya, the nation's second largest city. Authorities told reporters that some of the men were watching gay porn and performing deviant sexual acts. Same-gender sex is not illegal in predominantly Muslim Indonesia, so gay men are prosecuted under strict anti-pornography laws. Most people in Indonesia practice a moderate form of Islam, but the semi-autonomous province of Aceh is governed by Sharia, a strict legal interpretation of the Quran. Men caught having sex there can be punished with up to 100 lashes in the public square. According to local reports about that Surabaya hotel raid, police confiscated condoms, mobile phones, and a flash drive with allegedly pornographic videos. All the men were forced to take HIV tests, a practice that several human rights groups have condemned. Each of them faces up to 15 years in prison. Hardline Muslim lawmakers are pushing to specifically outlaw gay sex in revisions to the criminal code now being discussed in Indonesia's House of Representatives.
In better news for LGBTQ people, civil marriage equality has finally come to Bermuda. Supreme Court Judge Charles Etta Simmons issued a ruling on May 5th that native Bermudan Winston Godwin and his Canadian fiancé, Greg DeRoche, have the right to marry in Bermuda under the British Overseas Territories Human Rights Act. On the facts, she wrote, the applicants were discriminated against on the basis of their sexual orientation when the registrar refused to process their notice of intended marriage. The government argued that under Section 33 of the Marriage Act 1944, it's been an offense for the registrar to authorize a marriage knowing that it was not legal. But Simmons stated flatly that same-sex couples are entitled to be married under the Marriage Act. Local church groups, reportedly assisted by right-wing evangelicals from the U.S., pushed for a referendum on marriage equality soon after the Godwin-DeRoche lawsuit became news. Bermudans opposed marriage equality by what was fortunately a non-binding 2-to-1 margin last June. Godwin told Bermuda's Royal Gazette newspaper this week that it had been a long road to get to this stage for me and Greg, but that the ruling is a big step in the right direction.
All eyes in France and around the world have been on the country's May 7th presidential runoff election, pitting centrist Emmanuel Macron against far-right Marine Le Pen, who has campaigned for the repeal of marriage equality. It may have gone unnoticed that the nation's top appeals court on May 4th rejected the effort of an anonymous 66-year-old psychotherapist to be identified on government documents as gender neutral. In its ruling, the court stated that the duality of gender as a civil status was necessary to the social and legal organization of which it is a cornerstone, and that the recognition of a neutral gender would have deep repercussions on French law and would require numerous legislative changes. The appellant, who identifies as intersex, was born with an indeterminate gender but was labeled male on their birth certificate. A court in Germany also rejected the creation of a third sex category last year. Alternatives to male or female on official documents, third gender or gender X, are currently only available to the citizens of India, Australia, New Zealand, and Nepal.
But the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear a challenge this week to a California law that bans therapists from trying to change the sexual orientation of LGBTQ patients under the age of 18. Such so-called reparative or pray-the-gay-away therapy has been denounced by every reputable mental health organization in the Western world as useless at best and psychologically damaging in many cases. The law applies to licensed doctors, psychologists, family therapists, and social workers. Violators can be disciplined by state licensing boards. The ban was challenged by licensed therapist and minister Donald Welch, who said it violates his religious rights. California officials urged the high court not to hear the appeal, arguing that the law only affects state-licensed therapy sessions. It does allow licensed providers to refer minors to religious leaders. A handful of other U.S. states also ban so-called conversion therapy for minors. Democrats have introduced a bill to outlaw the practice nationwide, but it has little chance of passage in the Republican-controlled Congress.
In this week's Queer News from Trumplandia, the U.S. president's second nominee for Secretary of the Army has bowed out even before Senate confirmation hearings could be scheduled. At around the time that the Pentagon was opening military service to transgender enlistees, Republican Tennessee State Senator Mark Green said at a town hall meeting,
"Now, if you poll the psychiatrists, they're going to tell you that transgender is a disease."
In announcing that he was withdrawing his nomination to give the president the ability to move forward, Green wrote that, "Tragically, my life of public service and my Christian beliefs have been mischaracterized and attacked by a few on the other side of the aisle for political gain." That claim failed to take into account that the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Republican John McCain, had expressed serious reservations about Green's nomination. Trump's first choice for Army Secretary, Wall Street billionaire Vincent Viola, backed out in February because of the complications of getting through the Defense Department's conflict of interest rules. Navy Secretary nominee Philip M. Bilden cited similar reasons for withdrawing his candidacy. Of the 58 posts at the Pentagon that require Senate confirmation, only one, Defense Secretary Jim Mad Dog Maddox, has been filled so far. The Trump administration hasn't even announced nominations for most of the others.
And finally, President Trump's much-anticipated Religious Freedom Executive Order this week turned out to be much ado about nothing. Responding to reports earlier in the week about what Trump was planning, including restricting women's access to health care and allowing licenses to discriminate against LGBTQ people, proudly out U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin charged Trump with being played as a puppet by Vice President Pence to advance an extreme right agenda. But after reviewing the exact wording of the edict, the ACLU, which had first promised to file a lawsuit against it, decided that the order was virtually toothless. The ACLU's first Latino and first openly gay executive director, Anthony Romero, called the signing ceremony an elaborate photo op with no discernible policy outcome. President Trump's prior assertions about this order, he wrote, have proven to be a textbook case of fake news.
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 6, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org. You can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
This is Lucia Chappell with a News Wrap update from Paris, France. In a landslide victory, independent candidate Emmanuel Macron has defeated hard-right Marine Le Pen of the National Front to become president of France, the country's youngest leader since Napoleon. Progressives and LGBTQ activists around the world breathed a sigh of relief as the racist, homophobic, anti-globalist campaign of Le Pen garnered just over a third of the vote. Macron demonstrated strong support for defending and expanding LGBTQ rights. I'm Lucia Chappell.
I really wanted to get up on stage. I really wanted to perform. I had done theater like all my life. So that was the drive behind it, because it certainly wasn't how I looked the first time, because I was ugly.
A curious correspondent left alone with Pandora Box just couldn't resist taking a peek at what's inside. But first, let's march to the music of a much earlier time.
Ethel Smythe, English composer and suffragist, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Ethel Smythe was born in England in 1858. At 19, a boundless love of music landed her at the Leipzig Conservatory in Germany, befriending Peter Tchaikovsky. Smythe went on to become the most important female composer in early 20th century English music. She wrote six operas, many chamber ensemble works, and in 1891 wrote The Mass in D. Toward grand romantic passions, most of them with women, she became involved in the women's suffrage movement, even composing its anthem, March of the Women. Once arrested during a suffragist demonstration, Smythe spent 3 months in prison. Loyal supporters arrived and marched around the prison courtyard singing her march song as she conducted them with a toothbrush from her prison cell window.
Shout, shout, oh, bring your song. Cry with the wind, for the dawn is breaking. March,
This Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Karen Burns in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Follow your favorite international LGBT radio show on Twitter at TWO Radio, read our blog at twopodcast.blogspot.com, and check out our fan page at facebook.com/thiswayoutradio. There are also links to all three at thiswayout.org.
The most controversial elimination of RuPaul's Drag Race Season 2 made our next guest an eternal fan favorite. We know of only one qualified correspondent who could get her to really tell all.
Show me what you got. Are you a winner? Can you make it hot? Don't be a loser. Take it to the top. Make it pop. Put the pedal to the metal. Hit hop. Non-stop.
I'm Miss Barbecue with Miss Pandora Box from RuPaul's Drag Race Season 2.
Anybody that's eaten my cherry pie raves about it.
How's the crust?
Crispy. And a little tender in the middle.
And the fruit?
Always ripe.
Is it juicy, Pandora?
It's overflowing with juices.
Would you say your cherry pie was succulent?
I would say it's succulent and a bit moist.
You getting hungry, Kim?
I'm getting hungry.
Welcome, Pandora.
Hi.
So excited to have you here. You've done so much in different realms. Music, theater, television, of course, from RuPaul's Drag Race. I saw you got started in New York.
In Rochester, New York.
In Rochester, yeah. New York, at a club called Infinity.
I had done drag, I think like a couple months before, at a drag party where everyone was getting in drag. Or a couple of people were getting in drag and other drag queens were putting them in drag. So I went there, but I was very coy, like, well, maybe, I don't know if I want to do it or not, but I really did.
Everybody's gotten in drag for the first time, and sometimes it sticks, sometimes it doesn't. What with you made it going, I want to do this?
It certainly wasn't the way that I looked, because I was fugly.
Were you a booger girl?
Only because I was dating the drag queen who put me in drag. I was dating her ex-boyfriend, and they weren't really exes, and I didn't really know that. And he came to the party with me, and I was like, oopsie. So she made me look real, real, real ugly. So I think really what made me want to do it is because I really did want to do it. Like, I really wanted to get up on stage. I really wanted to perform. I had done theater, like, all my life. So that was the drive behind it, because it certainly wasn't how I looked the first time.
Now, did you always see drag and theater coming together naturally, or did you always keep them separate?
Well, I didn't even know that drag was really a thing that you could do, like a, I'm going to say career, but at the beginning, it's like, here's a dollar, thank you for coming out.
Right.
So yeah, no, I guess I did always want to combine them, because it is a form of theater, basically.
Where do you get your ideas for your theater projects?
I wrote a lot when I was a kid, and a lot of times I was too shy to speak, so I wrote it out and wrote things. And when I was in the fifth grade, we had to write letters to our teacher, and we could write whatever we wanted to. And I wrote in the letter, I'm like, what if a student wanted to write a play and put it on for the school? Could that happen? And she said, yes, we could do that. So I wrote a play called The Trouble with Christmas, and we performed it at our school.
How old were you then?
Whatever you are in fifth grade.
Ten years old?
Yeah.
Wow. Were you in your own world? Did you have a bunch of friends? Were you that loner? Or?
I think I felt like I was a loner, especially as I got older. We moved in second grade, like halfway through, and the new school was a little tougher. I was getting picked on, and before I never really experienced that. So I think I felt like I was a loner, but I did have friends, so I wasn't really a loner. It was just, it was a lot of inner turmoil going on in my mind.
A lot of angsty stuff going on.
Well, yeah, and just because I think I didn't get myself. I didn't understand that you could be gay. That wasn't on my radar. And I think I was also like asexual at a certain point in time. So it's like, I didn't think about it. And we didn't know any gay people. And all I knew is that people were picking on me for this. And it wasn't really on TV a lot. So I watched like Carol Burnett and Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin. And I just wanted to be like them. And I didn't realize that I was going to dress up like a woman and kind of be like them. But I just really admired them. And they made me laugh and made me feel all warm and fuzzy inside.
There are very few times where you're really, really serious in your work. Do you see humor as a way of putting your message across?
At this point, even if I try to do it, that it's remotely serious, people just think I'm being funny. So I can't escape it. Even if I do like a normal lip sync number and go out there and it's supposed to be serious, eventually within like a minute, it's going to be funny because they're just waiting for it. So I'm like, all right, sometimes you just have to give people what they want. And I think that definitely comedy was a defense mechanism when I was younger. I guess I'm just naturally funny.
Are you funny at home? Like with your family, with your boyfriend? Or
my boyfriend would probably say no, because sometimes I'm cranky. Because I don't know if you know, but this business can be tough sometimes.
No.
So
this business is tough.
This business called show can be tough. So sometimes at home, especially if I've been traveling, I'm tired and grouchy. And so unfortunately, he gets the brunt of it because we live together. Yeah, I'm sure he probably would rather have the show me sometimes, too.
What's the best and what's the worst part of drag?
I think the best part is just being able to entertain people. And you kind of are the master of your own destiny. Like, you can kind of pick what you want to do. Like, if you're doing a number, you're in total control of it. At the bar, you can do whatever you want, really. And I think the worst part, oh, there's so many.
This is Barbecue with Pandora Box. Since RuPaul's Drag Race has come out and drag has gone into the mainstream, I have seen more of a, I won't say competitive, but a judgment feel from the typical person on the street who watches the show. How do you handle that queen that comes over and goes, the shoes would have been better if they were glitter, girl, or you should have had glitter on your eyebrows, or everyone thinks they're an expert now?
Yeah. Well, I would be shocked if somebody actually came in person and said anything that they say online to me or any of the queens. Because that's the thing. They don't usually say it in person, and they would never say it in person. But they would go beep, 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 and type it and send it. I don't know what typewriter makes that noise. But, you know, beep, 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 beep.
I thought that was a special typewriter you had.
Yeah, just
he makes that noise.
I don't know. They've got that keyboard courage. And I think one of the negative sides of Drag Race is that in the show, we read each other a lot. And I think people think that they're reading, but they don't know how to read, which reading, for anyone that doesn't know, is the art form of, how would we phrase it?
Catty observations of another person.
Yeah. That are generally true, close-ish.
Close-ish.
But funny.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. It's got to have a little snark, a little humor to it.
A little bite.
Otherwise, it's not good.
Exactly.
And people online don't realize that. Well, I hope. Some of them are just assholes. That's really just what it is. They sit there. They don't have a life. They're not doing anything. Or they're like a teenager. That's why I try not to engage, because I'm like, oh my God, I do not need to be an adult yelling at a teenager. It's our social media culture that they feel like they can just be assholes. Drag Race now has that fan base. And some of them can get really, really nasty. And it's like, you're going against what RuPaul says and everything. Yeah. Like, RuPaul has literally said, stop doing this. Like, she said it on the show. She said it at one of the finales. She made a long speech about it. So.
Oh, wow. Here's a subject. Drag phobia. That's a term I've coined within the LGBT community, where the gays love who you are, but they would never date you. Or you're too much like a woman, so therefore they don't want to be around you, kind of deal.
Right.
Have you experienced that before Drag Race, after Drag Race?
Oh, yeah, all the time. We always used to say drag queens are like car accidents. Everyone wants to see one. No one wants to get involved in one.
Mm.
Yeah, because the gay culture, well, our society in general, frowns on effeminate men.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this whole masculinity thing. And that's really what it all stems from, because it's just hard being a working woman. And I think that, yeah, I mean, I definitely had an issue dating. A lot of times they do just think that you want to be a woman, or you are a woman, or you're too effeminate. For some drag queens, that's true. And so what?
Do you miss when drag was underground?
No, because I make more money.
You seem very open in our conversations that we've had, although people have told me that Pandora Box does come across guarded.
We're drag queens and we are gay. So you have to be. And I actually grew up getting picked on every day. That's sometimes why my guard is up, because it's still that residual kind of thing. And also being a gay man and living this gay life, you never know what's coming for you.
That sounds exhausting.
It is exhausting. And actually, maybe this has been a cathartic journey, barbecue. And maybe I'm realizing, saying it, that that probably is a big thing that I probably don't need to do as much as I did before. You live and you learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I don't know, I was never really about labels or anything. I feel like it pigeonholes us into certain things. But when I learned about gender fluidity, as soon as I heard that description, I'm like, oh my God, that's me.
That's me, yeah.
I was like, that's it. Like that, where was this like several years ago?
Yeah, it was like, non-existent.
So labels are good in that fact that it can help you. And it did. I read that and I was like, no, that's just what I am. It's kind of like a weight was lifted off me that I didn't even know was still there. Because things that happened in your childhood can still affect you later in life. You're like, oh, really? I'm not over this yet.
Do you feel like you're still coming into your own?
I do, although I feel like that I should have happened already. I think it's this business, too, that kind of prevents you a little bit, because you constantly have to keep going and evolving and changing, and it makes it a little harder.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, my goodness. This has been such a wonderful experience talking to you. This is one of those moments that I've always wanted to dive into with another queen and really dig deep on why we do what we do. And I think you are so talented.
Please go to PandoraBox.com. There's two X's in box. Thank you.
Because X marks the spot. This has been Pandora Box with Ms. Barbecue. And we will end with a beautiful song by Ms. Pandora Box called Different.
I'm different. You're different. We're different. People say that you're different. In what kind of way? So different, but yeah, come what may, I'm different. That's the way I'll stay.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Francis O'Brien, Wenzel Jones, Lucia Chappelle, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Karen Burns, and Miss Barbecue contributed program material with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Pandora Box performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. Look for This Way Out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2TLC Yamba, New South Wales, 4NAG Yeppoon, Queensland, 5PBA Salisbury, South Australia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned!
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Puerto Rico has a poverty rate approaching 50% and a public debt that amounts to over $20,000 per inhabitant, with its poverty rate more than double that of the United States' poorest state, Mississippi. Puerto Rico had serious long-term economic problems that, like its current massive public debt, have been historically papered over.
Most of the media attention on Puerto Rico's debt has focused on technical issues relating to the solvency of municipal bonds and austerity measures. Ignored is the history of how U.S. policies have resulted in more than 3.5 million Puerto Ricans being affected by its colonial status.
The bottom line is that Puerto Rico is the United States colony that it decided to take by force 117 years ago and has since treated like a resented orphan it has consistently undernourished politically and economically. Puerto Rico's current fiscal crisis is, in this sense, really a crisis of American colonial policies.
Meanwhile, amidst the poverty and debt, the hedge fund vultures and Wall Street banks and lawyers are circling Puerto Rico. They are sensing a fiscal death spiral they can feed off and care little about the consequences for millions of residents as they manipulate a financial system devoid of any social conscience.
The board appointed to oversee Puerto Rico's debt restructuring is turning the island's recession into a depression of a magnitude seldom seen around the world. Unemployment already at 12.4% and soaring.
The plan, which puts the creditors' interests above those of the island's economy and people, has created a debt-death spiral. And here to talk with us about the junta, its effects, and the resistance to it is Antonio Carmona Reyes, a social science professor at the University of Puerto Rico, a militant with the Associated University Professors, and a pro-independence activist.
Tell us what unfolded in the island today, where there was discussion of a national strike. What were the dimensions of the general strike in progress? And thanks for being with us.
Thank you, and hello to all radio listeners. I'm here in the streets of Río Piedras near the UPR campus. Today was certainly the largest and most significant demonstration and mobilization in the history of Puerto Rico. Not even back in the 30s could we count on nearly 100,000 people taking to the streets. Most of them were mobilized by trade unions, students and professors from the university, religious groups, other civil society organizations, all who said no to the junta and no to repaying a debt that has not yet been audited.
Antonio Carmona, tell us more about the labor sectors that joined the island-wide strike, what the fiscal and labor policies of the administration of the governor, Ricardo Rosario, and the fiscal control board were that they were protesting.
Since last year, it's been about a year since PROMESA law was passed in Washington, setting up the junta, setting up the fiscal control board to govern over Puerto Rico. In the last elections, the conservative annexation party and Ricky Rosselló won the elections. promised the people of Puerto Rico that this debt was repayable, that we could make structural adjustments to finance the repaying of this unaudited debt. And as soon as Ricardo Rosselló came into power in January, immediately he started, and his group and his party, the New Progressive Party, started making policies or taking on policies and legislation that would gear towards labor flexibility. The latest was just a couple of days ago when the Puerto Rican legislature and the Ricardo Rosselló passed this law, the 938 law, which annuls all collective negotiations of the public sector and reduce benefit for the public sector workers. Examples of these would be reduction in Christmas bonuses, reduction in vacation time, also reducing sick leave days. And I didn't think that this 1st of May was going to be that big, but after they passed this law, apparently the working class had no other choice but to get out on the street and demonstrate massively, letting the world know that we are not happy with these cuts, with this legislation, nor are we happy with this dictatorial junta.
Antonio, we have great power, and we are going to make you governor for a week.
Oh, so, that'd be great.
In short term, what would you do, assuming the legislature there went along with you, to solve not just the superficial problems, but the basis, the root of the problems that Puerto Rico has?
There are two answers to this. One is what I would love to see immediately, and what would I do realistically as a governor together with the legislature. What I would want to do is to declare independence, restructure our political system, our economical system, make it much more democratic, have the people enjoy sovereignty. But things are much more complicated in our colonial status. So what I would do is immediately commission an audit of this debt, make it transparent, see who took out these loans, under which conditions were these loans taken, and were these loans legal? I mean, was it legal for these people to take out these loans? Look at who's responsible and jail them. That's what I would do within the first week of becoming governor, as you put it.
I like that.
Well, yeah. you know, since you've mentioned that as one of the things that you would do, I want to talk more about the university students, the professors, workers, yeah, and activists have been rising up angry. Their voices have been out there against the passage of a bill that would eliminate the government-funded debt audit commission that was created in 2015. Tell us about the audit of the island's territory's $70 billion-plus debt.
Yes, there was a commission set up in the previous government to audit the debt with a couple of legislators from two different parties, lawyers, professors from the university itself, to look at the debt. And some initial findings suggested that about 50% of this debt was illegal. And what Ricardo Rosselló did when he came in is he put all his efforts into abolishing this commission. This led a group of people called the Citizen Front to audit the debt, to mobilize at the university, among the lawyers' guilds, and throughout the rest of civil society to reinstate this commission. The commission was reinstated, but then the legislature, House of Representatives as well as the Senate of Puerto Rico, voted to abolish it. Now we're without any kind of legal body to do so. Since the strike started, the rector of the Rio Piedras campus of the University of Puerto Rico has made efforts to create an alternative audit body or organization to audit the debt. We certainly have qualified people at the University of Puerto Rico, economists, lawyers, and other experts to carry out an audit. And that's what people are asking for. And from all parties, all ideological corners, and people from different views on the status of Puerto Rico. We don't want to pay a debt that we don't know. It's like going to a restaurant and you're getting a bill, but it's not a detailed bill. It doesn't say what you're paying for. So the strike at the university, which I must say, it's not only a student strike, it's a student strike, it's a professor strike. The non-academic staff are also on strike. And we're on strike because we don't want the government to close down the public university, which is what we're afraid of, you know, what we're afraid that the current government wants right now. The Puerto Rican, the government of Puerto Rico, as well as the administration, which is appointed by the government of Puerto Rico and the annexation party, suggested that we reduce the budget by $500 million. That's more than half of our budget. Numbers were thrown here and there. Then it went back to 250. Then it went to 400. And now what we heard just a couple of days ago is that the budget for the entire university system will be reduced by around $150 million. But not only that, they're also imposing a tuition hike by, it's like three times the amount of what people pay to register for courses.
You know, one of the things I must say that the last time I spoke to you off air, you were in the midst of, there was an occupation. People were storming into the office of the president of the university.
Correct.
It's been such a seat of activity. And help us understand more about the university as a national symbol of culture and tradition and pride in Puerto Rico, because it has a very specific significance.
Yes, you know, Puerto Rico, the University of Puerto Rico is the largest university in the Caribbean with around 60,000 students. And we have 11 campuses throughout the island. The largest campus is the city of San Juan in Rio Piedras. University of Puerto Rico is really the brain of our society. Out of the University of Puerto Rico, we have most of our professionals graduating from there. Everything in the arts and sciences, our law school, our medicine, and the largest hospital on the island belongs to the University of Puerto Rico. Yeah, so the University of Puerto Rico is the life of the country economically. And we have, you know, economists and some experts, you know, who have, you know, shown and proven and documented how much the University of Puerto Rico contributes to the economy of the country, and how it's possible that the economy will collapse completely if the university is dismantled or privatized, as the current government would like to see. Yeah.
There are so many different ways that Puerto Rico is discriminated against, as against states in the United States, both with regard to the debt, with regard to ships coming directly into your ports, and so on and so forth. Do you think you can in any way get fair treatment from the United States? Should we be independent? I know there's a plebiscite coming up. What can solve this problem?
Well, again, you know, there are two answers to that. One is, you know, the overall answer that would be the Antonio Carmona Báez answer. And for that would be independence, sovereignty. But even before sovereignty, and whether we, you know, we become the 51st state, or we become an independent republic, or we rearrange our relationship with the United States, the first thing that has to happen is that we be granted more sovereignty and more power over our immediate environment, our economy. Puerto Rico is a colony in a classical sense, I would say, a non-incorporated territory, where, as you were saying, you know, according to the cabotage law, we're required to import everything from U.S. ports, making life much more expensive than many places in the United States, while income and salaries are at the lowest in the United States. There's also been this strategy used by previous governments of both the Popular Democratic Party as well as the Annexation Party to have industrialization by invitation. So we're used to having large industries like the pharmaceuticals, for instance, come here and not pay taxes and take all the profits. We're talking about close to $30 billion a year leaves Puerto Rico, $30 billion in profits, and this non-tax profits. And whereas the small businesses, Puerto Rican businesses, are punished. You know, they have higher taxes for everything that they produce or they distribute. So there are a lot of things that can happen. You know, I was a member of, I am a member of the Working People's Party, the PPT, Partido del Pueblo Trabajador, and candidate for the mayoral candidate for the capital city, San Juan. And in our party, we had, you know, it's a left party. Our program is very similar to Bernie Sanders' campaign. Actually, Bernie Sanders came to Puerto Rico prior to the primaries, and it was a beautiful moment because, you know, although we cannot endorse Bernie Sanders, his idea for Puerto Rico was the same as our party. And inside our party, we have people from, you know, lots of people who are pro-independence, other people who just want to have a different relation to the United States, to alter our relation to the United States, to the political status, and some people, even people who are in favor of annexation. Remember that most Puerto Ricans live in the United States nowadays. So although the status is there, it's central, it's a very important thing. I think everyone can agree that we do live in a colony. We want to change this. But we also have to take on the responsibility and change our way of doing politics. We have to eliminate that elite, that political elite that has ruled Puerto Rico for the last 60 years and that has collaborated or has been accomplice to American colonialism in Puerto Rico.
One of the things that I thought was interesting, and I'm interested in your opinion on this, the Citizen Front had been calling for exploring the possibility of initiating a citizens' participatory audit. A strategy, yes, which had been used in, I believe, Chile and Indonesia, Romania. Can you talk about that? Do you think that's something to work towards? Where does the energy from the general strike, which was so large and vibrant in Puerto Rico, get placed?
Well, yes, this is the Frente Ciudadana para la Auditoría, the Citizen Front for a public audit, has been very active, and they're a very important point of reference in mobilizing. Actually, one of the biggest demonstrations that we had, and unfortunately the most violent, was in front of the Capitol building when the legislature was about to vote on dismantling this commission to audit the debt. The experts and those organizing that front wanted to go in, give testimony, and actually just see the whole process of dismantling. And the government closed the doors. We were not able to go inside to the Capitol building. And as some people tried to go in, the police responded by throwing tear gas. So there's a lot of repression as well now, you see, from the police, as we've also seen going back to the march, a very beautiful, successful march. There was music, families, you know, with kids on the street, people of all walks of life, all the social movements represented there. And then towards the end, the police started encroaching upon the crowd, and again, responding with tear gas. Mm. So whether we're demonstrating or trying to exercise our rights in observing the legislature process, the current government, I just have to say that Rocio looks more and more like Trump. Yeah. Mm.
So as we just finish for this time and need to acknowledge that we have to continuously do more programming on what is happening in Puerto Rico, on April 13th, the U.S. Justice Department rejected the plebiscite. Ken had mentioned the plebiscite before, proposal because of unclear wording and omission of the current Commonwealth status as an option. So where do you see and how critical is the issue, and where is the independence movement at now? Have they actually been supported more as a result of the terrifying austerity measures being put into effect and which are driving more people to be in the United States from Puerto Rico than on the island itself?
Yes. Yeah, very interesting because, you know, back in January, there was this what we call the Junta Soberanista. So they're pro-independence, pro-status quo with some alteration, more autonomy. Different groups on the left and center-left have united to participate in the June 11th plebiscite. And we thought it was very important because the government now in power is an annexation government, and they won on the promise that they will get statehood, that will become a state through this referendum. But they would allow the people of Puerto Rico to choose between sovereignty, whatever that means, whether it be a republic, whether it be an associated republic or free associated state, or on the one hand, or on the other, annexation, become the 51st state. And then the U.S. government comes in, steps in and says, no, you also have to put territory. You have to put the current status of Puerto Rico on this referendum. So now all the pro-independent and even the status quo party, the Popular Democratic Party, is now boycotting these elections. So the only ones who are going to vote in these elections are pro-statehooders. And we're talking about, you know, less than 40% of the population. So as far as I'm concerned, and as far as the rest of the majority of Puerto Ricans are concerned, this referendum is not worth it. We're going to have to find another way to deal with our political status. And I am afraid that, you know, the tensions that come out of all the resistance that comes as a result of the imposition of the junta and their austerity measures is what's going to mobilize the entire country and eventually let us decide what our political status should be. So very interesting times coming up this week, throughout the next month and the entire summer. I definitely ask that you continue your report on Puerto Rico. And I'm really glad that you called. I'm really thankful for the opportunity to share this. And I hear that also in New York, we also had support from the diaspora today.
Yes.
And I also thank, and I'm very grateful, me, myself, being from the diaspora originally, I'm very thankful for all the solidarity that we received from New York and the United States.
Oh, indeed. And just lastly, by the way, were there people who were injured at the events today?
Yes, there were a few people who were injured through pepper spray when the police rushed into a crowd. A couple of people cut their knees. Nothing too bad. And about seven people were arrested. But no major clashes up till now. But you know what? We still have about four more hours. So who knows what will happen.
And then just maybe in a minute left. So all of this seems to be building to an organizing crescendo, certainly for yourself, myself, Ken. We hope will lead to independence. But are there other things that you would tell those people here that we should do to support our sisters and brothers on the island who are fighting against the Promesa Agreement, against the junta that is initiating horrific austerity measures and driving the island into a deep depression?
Yes, any help is highly appreciated. You know that the junta meets alternately once here, 1 month here, 1 month in New York. So every time they meet in New York, I would really hope that the diaspora and everyone else who has demonstrated their solidarity throughout the years shows up to those junta meetings and make loud their voice against this injustice that is being committed, because we're really talking about displacement of a population. There are many of us who really do not want to go and want to, you know, to build an alternative here in Puerto Rico. So, yes, please, write congressmen, call in, use social media, but also demonstrate at every junta meeting in New York City.
We will indeed. Antonio Carmona Reyes, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and be careful at the university. Be careful on the streets in the 4 hours that are left in a dangerous situation. But also continue to set the pace for those of us here, which is what our comrades in Puerto Rico have done with their organizing against right reaction, against the corporatocracy takeover of the junta. And that's what we've got to do. So continue to show us the way.
Thank you very much. And un gran saludo para todos nuestros hermanos y nuestras hermanas en Nueva York y en Estados Unidos. Thank you so much. I appreciate the solidarity. Much love to you all.
Gracias por todo. And we have been speaking with Antonio Carmona Reyes. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In 1956, the state of Mississippi set up a taxpayer-funded entity, the purpose of which was to defend white supremacy by infiltrating the civil rights movement. In one of the largest acts of domestic surveillance in U.S. history prior to September 11th, the Mississippi State Sovereignty Committee intimidated activists, spied on their ranks, and was involved in the violent suppression of the movement. They collected hundreds of thousands of files on more than 87,000 Americans. In 1998, the commission's records were opened by a court order revealing the state's deep complicity in the 1964 murders of three civil rights workers in Mississippi. Yet, unlike the FBI's COINTELPRO, this history of the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission is little known. Award-winning African-American filmmaker Dawn Porter set out to change that with her film Spies of Mississippi, which we're featuring today. We're offering this gripping and timely documentary as a thank you gift for your pledge of support to KPFA and to Against the Grain during our spring fund drive. Let's start with an edited excerpt from the film.
Lyndon Johnson said, there's America, there's the South, and then there's Mississippi.
Mississippi was a violent place in the 1950s and 1960s. As far back as I can remember. Any kind of civil rights agitation was a death-defying act.
The Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission was Mississippi's spy agency during the civil rights movement.
The Sovereignty Commission wanted to know who the activists were in the black community.
Down in Mississippi.
They were out to stop overt efforts at integration.
Down in Mississippi, where I was born.
It's state government itself. We're not just talking about some rednecks on the street or pulling a song. This is defiance at its highest levels.
We knew we were being followed. I knew my life was in danger.
This is still the United States of America, and you don't treat American citizens this way.
You will be arrested for parading without a permit.
How far the Sovereignty Commission went in terms of crossing legal lines, I think it is accurate to say that they cross them all the time.
Way down in Mississippi.
Looking at the United States, Mississippi is in the center of the state at the southernmost tip. Mississippi definitely is considered the Deep South. Growing up in Mississippi, I'm the youngest of 12 children. My parents were sharecroppers when I was born. So naturally, being a sharecropper, I did a lot of work in the fields. When I went to school, at that particular time, growing up, especially as black, the books we received and used were hand-me-down books once they became obsolete for the white students.
It was to keep that whole system that really had its roots in slavery. These are the people who cleaned their homes, worked their land. And if they could do more than that, they might actually become equal. And they never wanted it to come to a point where there would be real equality.
There was a higher percentage of African Americans living in Mississippi than in any other state. At one time, it was a majority. Those were the numbers that drove the intensity of the opposition to integration, that so many white people could not comprehend a reversal of the roles of whites and blacks. and they thought that blacks would dominate the state in almost every way. The political atmosphere in Mississippi in the middle 1950s was beginning to change very drastically.
By 1956, Brown versus Board of Education had been passed. The great Supreme Court ruling that said that you couldn't discriminate within education on the basis of race. The legislature of Mississippi was almost 100% segregationist. And many of them rabid segregationists at the time who felt that the struggle was starting to turn against the state and that the federal government was gaining power to enforce civil rights laws, and they create a special agency with the direct mission to preserve segregation.
In the legislature of 1956, one of the major bills that was passed during that session was a bill to create something called the Sovereignty Commission.
I'm sure that you will not fail to enact an appropriate state sovereignty bill, which will enable us during the next 2 years to maintain a successful fight for preserving the separation of the races in this state.
At that time, it seemed to be a harmless kind of legislation. It was more like a white chamber of commerce. Then we began to ask questions about it, about how that bill could be abused. It passed, however, and was enacted by the legislature and signed by Governor Coleman and set in motion.
This is Mississippi, the central state, the heart of the South.
It started out as a public relations campaign with films like Message from Mississippi, letting the world know that people liked the system of segregation in Mississippi and that nothing should ever change it.
Out of the statewide pattern of segregation, mutual respect and cooperation among the races, has arisen a productive, law-abiding way of life. Reverend J.W. Jones, colored pastor of New Albany and editor of a statewide colored newspaper, has this to say.
We have far less crime in our race in Mississippi in proportion to the population than in any state in the nation. I believe this is because of the way of life in Mississippi.
They sent out mailings, they sent out speakers, they invited newspaper people into the state, talked to them, tried to persuade them that, you know, all is well here. We got some good black people, and we treat them well.
The Sovereignty Commission became an instrument of state power in enforcing segregation.
If you registered to vote, you immediately became an enemy of the state. If you rented from a white person, you were kicked out. If you worked for a white person, you were fired. And yet we got thousands of people to take on an entire state that was committed to an apartheid system that would make South Africa blush.
It was the beginning of the so-called civil rights era. That's when the tensions began to rise over what was coming, what people thought was coming down the road.
Within 3 to 4 years of its being formed, the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission transforms itself into a full-blown spy agency with a whole network of investigators and agents to go around the state exploring things that were going to possibly change what people euphemistically called the Mississippi way of life.
I knew H.H. Humes when I was a kid growing up in Cleveland. He was the pastor of this church called St. Paul Missionary Baptist Church. The people liked Dr. Humes because he was a whooping preacher. He could holler and stomp real loud and put the fear of fire and brimstones in you. He was one of the biggest preachers in Cleveland. People respected him. I had no idea that he was an informant for the Sovereignty Commission.
We were always looking for the white guys in the pickup trucks down the road to take tag numbers down when we were leaving. But we never decided to look around the room. We were not understanding that perhaps people were being paid who looked like us to spy and report back.
Percy Green, editor of the Jackson Advocate, the biggest newspaper for the African American community at the time, didn't like the new, younger membership of the NAACP that might be a little more strident than the older generation, and ended up supplying a pretty steady stream of intelligence for information from within the black community.
There are all too many Negroes all over this country who have segregated minds. They have been told so long that they don't count, that they are inferior, that they've come to believe that. This is the tragedy of segregation, not merely what it has done to the Negro in terms of physical inconvenience, but what it has done to his soul, what it has done to him psychologically.
The future of the United States of America may well be determined here in Mississippi, for it is here that democracy faces its most serious challenge. Can we have government in Mississippi which represents all of the people? This is a question which must be answered in the affirmative if these United States are to continue to give moral leadership to the free world.
There is no case in history where the Caucasian race has survived social integration. We will not drink from the cup of genocide.
And just over the period of a little over 2 weeks, you had 50 major demonstrations across the country in all parts of the United States, not being created by the federal government, they're being created by people who are dissatisfied with being treated as second-class citizens. And this is the difficulty. We have to do something about it. We have to deal with it.
By 1960 in the Deep South, the sit-in movement has just exploded. The Sovereignty Commission sees this happening in this rapid development and growth of an organized civil rights movement where you do have people who call themselves civil rights activists. And so the Sovereignty Commission has to ramp up its own efforts to defy the civil rights movement and these activists.
The State Sovereignty Commission really assumed its mature and most malignant form after 1960, after Ross Barnett was governor of the state. The agency really became sort of the Stasi of Mississippi under Ross Barnett.
They double the number of spies they have themselves. They decide they're going to try and reach out. Well, how can we do this? These detective agencies kind of volunteer their services.
These private detective agencies had both white investigators and black investigators.
They had four or five detective agencies that they hired to help do the work of the Sovereignty Commission to investigate these people, to attend civil rights meetings.
And that is an edited excerpt from the documentary film Spies of Mississippi. My name is Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. And I'm here today to ask for your pledge of support for KPFA, for Against the Grain, and so pleased to be able to offer to you as a thank you gift not only KPFA, obviously the most important thing of all, but a really remarkable documentary about an entity that most of us have never heard of, and that is the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission. When Mississippi was 0.0 for some of the most important struggle in the United States in the 20th century, when The stakes were so incredibly high as people were organizing against white supremacy and segregation. The state of Mississippi set up this commission to try and infiltrate the movement and repress it. And it's, a history all of us should know. It's not known anywhere near as much as the history of COINTELPRO that the FBI led, even though this was enormously extensive, but not just as a way of knowing our history, but because actually these questions of surveillance are really questions that are absolutely with us today, especially as we see another upswell of social movement cycles and the kind of surveillance and repression that I think all of us realize operates in these times. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call if you would like to pick up the DVD Spies of Mississippi for a $120 pledge. It's directed by award-winning African-American film director Dawn Porter. If you would like to spread your payments out over 6 months, that's $20 a month. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. Easy to remember is 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also go to kpfa.org if you click on films and then scroll down to films at the $120 level. You'll see Spies of Mississippi there. It's another way to pledge and support us. Even saves us a little money if you do it online. But honestly, however you do it, we're grateful. We just want you to do it right now. And as extra incentive, a generous listener in San Francisco, Gail, has put up $250 as a challenge match. And that means that she will double your pledge dollar for dollar up to the level of $250. So it's a great time to pledge right now. And I'm hoping you'll join us. I'd like to go back to more audio from this very moving film. As you will see, it's a very multi-layered. So I'm going to hope, I'm going to take a leap of faith that you will call and pledge because you know that this is a time where your money goes further, thanks to Gail in San Francisco, who will match your pledge, that you will call while we go to more audio. The number to call is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge at kpfa.org. Let's listen now to more from Spies of Mississippi.
Our phones were tapped. The Sovereignty Commission has files of speeches that I gave and others gave extemporaneously, but they were copied, taped, typed, and stored in their files.
There's 160,000 pages of spy reports talking about tracking Medgar Evers, talking about preparing for an arrival of Martin Luther King into the state of Mississippi, getting information in advance about what his route would be and what the strategy would be to undercut him.
In many cases, as it pertains to specific civil rights events or organizations, how little the Sovereignty Commission actually knew compared to what it thought it knew. And oftentimes that was because of the ability of civil rights activists to funnel the information that they wanted to funnel back to the Sovereignty Commission through these people who they knew were black informants.
It wasn't just the people who were out on the front lines. It was everybody. My parents' involvement in the civil rights movement, they would help people pass literacy tests. And then once they got registered to vote, my parents would collect the money and pay their poll taxes. They weren't on the front lines, they weren't marchers, they were at the background. Anybody who was trying to change the system in whatever small way they were trying to do it, you were suspect.
The Klan had more or less disappeared in the 1920s and hadn't been much through the 30s and 40s and 50s. But it came back with a vengeance, of course, in the 1960s and thoroughly terrorized the state with its campaign of bombing.
But is it violence wherein our communities are jeopardized by such sex-crazed, idiotic mobs as the Deacons or the NAACP? I say, ladies and gentlemen, we've got to make our stand. And I say that it is not violence when we protect ourselves.
Almost everyone was intimidated, really intimidated by the force of those who most rigidly opposed any change in the racial status quo. It was a time of almost unbelievable thought control, and it led to some of the most unfortunate events in the history of the civil rights movement.
We hope to send into Mississippi this summer upwards of 1,000 teachers, ministers, lawyers, and students from all around the country who will engage in what we're calling freedom schools, community center programs, voter registration activity, research work, work in the white communities, and in general, a program designed to open up Mississippi to the country.
We noticed that we were finally getting the attention of the country, because what we had to do was not only fight against the state of Mississippi, but we had to fight the United States of America on its indifference.
It was amazing to see that many young people that actually cared, because most privileged kids, and these were privileged kids, they didn't have to do that. I thought they were all just self-centered young people that were spoiled, but that was not the case for most of them that came.
The Sovereignty Commission, like the Klan, viewed Freedom Summer as an invasion. I mean, they basically thought, we're under siege, this is war.
The Jackson Police Department operates with the best demonstration deterrent of any city in the country. In addition to Thompson's tank, armor-plated and equipped with 9 machine gun positions, the arsenal includes cage trucks for transporting masses of arrested violators. Searchlight trucks, each of which can light 3 city blocks in case of night riots. Police dog teams, trained to trail, search a building, or disperse a mob or crowd. Mounted police, for controlling parades and pedestrian traffic. And compounds and detention facilities to hold and house 10,000 prisoners. Along with these ironclad police facilities, there are new ironclad state laws outlawing picketing, economic boycotting, and demonstrating. Other laws to control the printing and distribution of certain types of information, and laws to dampen complaints to federal authorities.
We called out the highway patrol and the guard and people like that. Keep them in line. We kept them in line. We locked up a lot of them. Put them in jail. For disorderly conduct, that sort of thing. The jails in Jackson were full. In several other places we had them.
I don't mind coming to jail. I don't mind suffering at all. And I will suffer some more just for my freedom. I want equal rights. I want equal rights.
The training in Ohio that we were doing for the young people that was coming for the 1964 Summer Project lasts for 2 weeks. The training had to do with preparing them for coming into Mississippi. Those three things you needed to be prepared for was to be beaten, to be put in jail, and to be killed. And if you're not prepared for all three of those, we won't hold it against you if you decide not to come.
Most likely a cop won't try to chunk you in here, but he will hit you across here. You can generally take those licks.
And that is an edited excerpt from the documentary film Spies of Mississippi, civil rights worker talking about training other people to go and resist white supremacy and segregation in Mississippi. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. And today is the second day of our spring fun drive. And I'm very pleased to be here today to support this radio station and this program financially by encouraging you to pledge your support in any way you can, honestly. If you'd just like to pledge money and not get a thank you gift, that's wonderful. If you'd like other thank you gifts, you can look for them on kpfa.org. But specifically in this hour, we're focusing on the documentary film available on DVD, Spies of Mississippi, for $120 pledge to KPFA. That's $20 a month over the course of 6 months. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Easy to remember is 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also go to kpfa.org and click on the support link there. Go to films. This documentary film is a $120 pledge. And that's another wonderful way to pledge and support us from wherever you are in the world or in the United States. This is a really tremendous film. It's, of course, you can never do justice to films by just playing the sound, but you might get the sense, even through the limited ways of playing this over the airwaves, that it is very well produced. It is what you can't see is just the richness of archival material in the documentary, which includes interviews like we just heard with someone who actually was part of the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, talking very openly in old age about how, in approving terms, how effective he thought the entity was in suppressing the civil rights movement by filling the jails up in Mississippi. It's full of images from the commission surveillance photos, thousands and thousands of files of the people they watched. You really get a sense of this sort of immense scale of this effort, which, as I mentioned before, is not well known at all, like the FBI's COINTEL program to surveil the left and infiltrate and disrupt the left. This was an enormously extensive effort to try and crush and repress the civil rights movement in Mississippi. And it's really is shocking stuff. It's also very moving. You can see, you really get a sense of the courage of the people who went up against everything that was arrayed against them. The documentary film includes interviews with them as well. It's meticulously researched. It's really well produced, and it is, I think, a wonderful documentary to view yourself, and then perhaps give as a gift. Pass it along. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-439-5732. And I should say, we still haven't made our match put up by Gail in San Francisco. So this is a wonderful time to call and pledge right now, because she's there challenging you, offering to match your pledge dollar for dollar. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. I'd like to go back to more soon, but I just want to remind listeners that this kind of information, I think, is crucial in a moment like this, where we have the right and the far right have emboldened in a way that we haven't seen like this in a very long time. And although we have ascendant social movements, there are all sorts of mechanisms in place to repress those movements, to surveil those movements, to try and discourage or intimidate those movements. And so to study the past, I think, is really crucial. And it also allows us to think about how we view the state, how we view these different entities, where often people hope to appeal to the state to be fair and so on. And it's, I think, useful to know the history of the state in looking at how it has dealt with movements from below, especially movements against oppression, movements of the left. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA or kpfa.org, and pick up a tremendous thank you gift, size of Mississippi, yours for $120 pledge. I'd like to say, just put it out there that if you're able to pledge at a higher rate, we would be ever so grateful. If you think that the work we do here on KPFA and Against the Grain is useful, let's say even maybe invaluable in a moment like this, and you're able to do so, think about contributing at a higher rate. And if you can't do that, if you can only contribute much less, we're also grateful for that. So I'm just going to appeal to those of you who are able to pledge at whatever rate to do so right now while we have a challenge still active. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Let's return now to more from this documentary film, The Spies of Mississippi. It's directed by Don Porter, award-winning filmmaker, 60 minutes long, and a part of American history that we all should know, and most of us don't.
Mickey Schwerner was a dedicated activist working to register voters in Mississippi. He was at a training session in Ohio prior to Freedom Summer. Agent X was at that same training session. A black agent who was describing himself as an activist. And he had access to information about the people involved. And he was going to share that information with the Sovereignty Commission, which he did.
So when the Sovereignty Commission comes over and begins spying on Mickey Schwerner, back in spring of 64, they're sharing that information with the Meridian Police Department. Well, the Meridian Police Department, according to, I've talked directly to the officers themselves, more than half the police force over there were probably Klansmen.
I met Mickey Schwerner and James Cheney when we went to Meridian to a COFO conference. Mickey was funny as he wanted to be. I mean, just every time you saw him, he had a smile on his face. James Cheney was a native of Meridian. I call him J.E., James Earl, so we call him J.E. He was always anxious to do something and was really, really enthusiastic about trying to organize people in different communities. When I met Andy Goodmans up in Oxford, and he was excited about coming here, I saw him when he was getting in his car, and he was just like a little kid at a carnival.
I met with Mickey Schwerner the day before he left the training session in Ohio. And he asked my opinion. Giat, should we go back into the show? I said, of course. I said, there's too much publicity nationally. This would be the most idiotic thing they could possibly do. I was wrong.
Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner went to investigate the burning of a church, firebombing of a church.
So the Sovereignty Commission was clearly responsible for funneling information about the whereabouts of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney that day that they were investigating the church burning to local officials in Neshoba County in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Those local officials, the sheriff's office in particular, would arrest Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney that day, take them to the jail, where that night they would be taken out of the jail and would disappear. And for the next several weeks, there was a massive manhunt looking for these disappeared civil rights activists.
Disappeared some time ago, and we know what happened to civil rights workers. We know what happened to Negroes in Mississippi when they disappear. Sometimes you find them in the river, sometimes you find them hanging from trees, and sometimes you don't find them.
I have no reason to believe that these people have been killed, and we don't have any information with the state police that would justify such a conjecture.
So you have the governor of Mississippi, Senator Eastland, they're all coming out publicly and saying, oh, this is a hoax. They're probably down there with Castro smoking cigars and Cuba and, you know, all this kind of talk. The time that Governor Johnson said that, he said that in Neshoba County. And where he was standing when he claimed it was a hoax, he was standing literally like less than a few miles from where the bodies were buried. 44 days later, the FBI gets tipped off and they do find where the bodies are buried and they do dig up the bodies.
There was a map that can be found in the Sovereignty Commission files today that indicates the direct location of the bodies. It's a hand-drawn map that shows them buried underneath this earthen dam. It is clearly more information that indicates that, again, the Sovereignty Commission knew exactly what had happened, knew where these guys were, and knew that they were dead long before this several-week, multi-month search for their bodies had concluded.
When those bodies were dug up, then suddenly there was no hiding place anymore. There was no hiding place for the Klan anymore. You know, the FBI was getting involved in the case. They were already involved in the case, but they were going to pursue the case. This one was not going to be ignored.
This country could not really reconcile. Why do three young people get killed for trying to register black people to vote, even in Mississippi?
Y'all know what my child was doing. He was trying for us all to make a better living. And he had two fellas from New York. Had their own home and everything. Didn't have nothing to worry. But they come here to help us. Did y'all know they come here to help us? They died for us.
When Agent X was working out of Canton, Mississippi, he reported the license plate off the station wagon that the three civil rights workers were later driving.
While the identity of Agent X was never officially revealed, a number of activists went through those files and asked the question, who was at these meetings that were compromised? Who was there when we were talking about these things that ended up in a file of the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission? And through a process of connecting the dots, it all led to one man, R. L. Bolden.
I knew R. L. very well. He was the vice president of the state NAACP, and he was intimately involved with us, and we didn't have any signs or indication that he was to the contrary. It was only through the diligence of late Senator Henry Kirksey who began to pinpoint things to determine that he was working with the State Sovereign Commission, and that had to do with him digging off into the files and looking at reports and seeing reports being given about certain specific meetings and him recollecting who was at the meeting. And everybody that attended that meeting were mentioned except one person that he knew was there. And that's when he came to the conclusion that since this is a pattern, that one person who is not mentioned at these meetings that I know was there have to be the one that's submitting the report.
And an excerpt from the documentary film directed by Don Porter, Spies of Mississippi. It's by about the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, innocuous sounding name, but one of the largest surveillance efforts in American history. Its network of informants spied on over 87,000 Americans, and it was actively involved in the murder, as you just heard, by the Klan of civil rights workers Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, as well as other acts, covering up other acts of violence and murder or aiding and abetting them. I'm Sasha Lilly alongside C.S. Song, and we are here on the second day of KPFA's Spring Fund Drive to raise money for Against the Grain and KPFA, and to offer to you a wonderful thank you gift. And that, of course, is beyond the really tremendous thank you gift of KPFA. A documentary film which is really meticulously researched and produced, full of archival footage, interviews with civil rights participants, as well as agents from the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission itself, including this Agent X, just discussed in the documentary film, who happened to be the, or seems to be, was with research indicated that he had actually been the vice president of the NAACP. He is also confronted in the film in old age. And thousands upon thousands of files on the people they watched, images of the commission surveillance photos. We haven't even gotten to Medgar Evers in the film. There's so much in here. It is a tremendous effort, a tremendous revelation about something that is really little known and should be better known to all of us. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call if you'd like to pick up a DVD of Spies of Mississippi, 1-800-439-5732. You can also find it at kpfa.org. Just click on the support link and you'll find it under films at the level of a $120 pledge. That breaks down to $20 a month if you want to pay for it over the course of 6 months. But this is a wonderfully, well, it's very powerful and it's very upsetting, but really wonderfully produced and I think important piece of, I was going to say history, but it's not, this is not about the misty past behind us. You know, this is actually, although of course the times of civil rights, the struggles were historic, certainly the question of surveillance is not one that has fallen off the radar. In fact, you know, following with George W. Bush, then Obama, Trump has only become more severe, more serious. And as we see the upsurge of social movements now, I think it's something we all should think about. I wanted to say that we did make the match that had been put up by Gail in San Francisco. And I want to thank several people for calling and pledging. We're really grateful to you. Clifford Washington in Sacramento, thank you so much for your pledge. Christopher Bricka in Ben Lomond, thank you so much. Cecilia Walls in Antioch, thank you for your pledge of support. Mae Smith in Salinas, we want to thank you. Nora Momtazi in Fairfax. Rachel Baller in Oakland, thank you so much. And Sebastian Abreu in Concord. They all called 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And took a stand for KPFA. People have also pledged at kpfa.org, and you can do so as well. We'd love to thank you as well. It is really our pleasure and privilege to be able to be here on these airwaves, but we don't take them for granted, and we hope that you don't as well. KPFA really does exist here, fund drive to fund drive, and it is with your pledge. It's this tremendous collective project that has gone on since 1949, but it always feels like walking on a tightrope because we can never know if we will ever make the money that we need to be on the air, and not just be on the air, but to be able to do the work that we have to do. So to keep us at the level where we're really vibrant and strong, and we're entirely dependent on you for that. So we hope you'll come through for us right now. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or kpfa.org.
$120. You can divide that into six equal monthly installments of $20 each, if that works better for you. 1-800-HEY-KPFA or kpfa.org. This is an amazing story. This is a story. This is a groundbreaking story. It's based on groundbreaking research, and I think it should be common knowledge. And the fact that it is not says something about the horrors that still lie in our historical record, not to mention the horrors that may exist around the corner. If you want to get informed, if you are interested in race and racial history and racial relations and racial oppression in this country or anywhere for that matter, we highly recommend this shocking and extremely important and relevant film to you. Six equal monthly installments of $20 if you'd like to do that, $120 all at once if you can afford it, 1-800-439-5732. You know, if you like listening to portions of the film, but you're just listening to portions of the film, and it's just portions of the film, get the whole film to watch, to see and hear the whole thing. Dawn Porter, award-winning filmmaker, has really outdone herself. It's an amazing collection of sound and visuals, and it is a story about white supremacy, and it's a story that, in my mind, speaks to the precarity of African Americans and people of color and of many other populations in this country today, the increasing precarity of those people. And we're not just talking about economic precariousness, we're talking about the precarity of the physical body, of what is could be done and what is being done to people of color, to immigrants, and attitudes toward African Americans as they've been changing over time and with the election in November, of course. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. It's for many people, I think it'll be an affordable thank you gift, $120. I think the average thank you gift to KPFA is about $100. 1-800-439-5732. But again, it's a thank you gift. It's your way of saying, first of all, thank you to KPFA for bringing us this kind of information, maybe information we never heard of before, maybe we would never hear of otherwise. And then we get to thank you. You get and you give. We give and you get. And I think it's a great two-way street. It's the only way that community-sponsored radio can do it for you. Social justice-oriented radio can exist. Please help us out. 1-800-HEY-KPFA.
1-800-439-5732 and kpfa.org. And C.S., we have 6 minutes left to the top of the hour, and we've been handed a quite substantial challenge by three generous listeners. Shreya, I hope I'm saying that right, Shreya in Oakland, Johan in Sebastopol, and Charles in Half Moon Bay have collectively put up $600 if we can raise the equivalent from now to the top of the hour, which means they will match your pledge dollar for dollar if you call 1-800-439-5732 or go to kpfa.org. You don't have to pledge $600, although, of course, if you could afford that, we would be grateful. Pledge what you can. You'll get the DVD, Spies of Mississippi, for a pledge of $120 or more. But pledge what you can right now, and they will match you. So there's no better time. If you've been listening and been intrigued hearing the portions from this film, which, of course, are partial, there's a lot that's not in here, including all of the controversy when there was plans to open the files and find out who supported the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, which, of course, was all sorts of politicians who didn't want to then be outed decades later in supporting this project. There's a lot of stuff that we, of course, couldn't play, you can get the full-length film for $120 pledge by calling 1-800-439-5732. And right now to the top of the hour, and it's waning, the time is waning, 4.5 minutes to go, less than that, your dollars are doubled. So now is the time to call and pledge if you appreciate the work that we do here on KPFA, if you appreciate the work we do here on Against the Grain, if you think these kinds of discussions, which are both historical, but in many ways about the present as well, matter, that this is the kind of information that we should be engaging with. If you think the legacy of white supremacy in this country is something that we should be interrogating, then please allow us to continue doing the work that you've come to expect from us, and your dollars are doubled right now. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. Let me say that more slowly. 1-800-439-5732. I'd like to thank David Harris in Sebastopol for his generous pledge of support. Jack Carmichael and Vallejo, thank you so much. Stephanie Banfield in San Francisco, thank you for your pledge of support. Drew Washburn in Seattle, Washington, thank you so much from Seattle. Sarah Paul in Walnut Creek, thank you for your pledge of support. Patricia Kocher in Alameda, we want to thank all of them. We'd love to thank you as well. Time is running out. And, you know, we do really operate here on a shoestring. So if you appreciate what we do here, then do know that your money, your pledge goes very far here. It's the kind of there are all sorts of causes we could contribute our money to, and so many just causes and needy causes. But what I would say about KPFA is that when you give your money to KPFA, it has the maximum impact, because rather than covering one issue or one cause, you are shining light on all of them together. And if that seems important to you, support us right now. 1-800-439-5732, whether it's history or the present or the connections between the two, we try to be here for you. And I'm hoping you'll be here for us right now. CS, we have just over 2 minutes to go to make this $600 match.
No time like the present. If you want to join the people who've been calling, who want to educate themselves, inform themselves, expand their horizons, get involved. Get involved by getting information that can help spur action and spur changes in public consciousness. 1-800-439-5732. It's not too late to call and get your dollars doubled. Get your dollars doubled. Your dollars go twice as far. It's an important, any matching period is really important for us. This film, for a $120 pledge, it personalizes the story. It makes it real. These are real human beings. You can relate to them. You can see them. You can listen to them. It's a very visceral experience, but it's also, of course, a story, a bigger story, a story about how people in Mississippi created this kind of a monster, not state-sanctioned spying, but state spying. And as Sasha was saying, spying and surveillance. I mean, we don't even know who's being spied on and surveilled today. Well, we do to some degree, but it's a constant issue. It's an ongoing issue. There's a constant struggle for justice in relation to that, in relation to race, in relation to equality. 1-800-439-5732. Eye-opening, totally relevant, essential, illustrative. It's a wonderful film. Give us a call. Not too late to call. 1-800-HEY-KPFA.
Yes, join Thomas Richardson in San Francisco and the many people who have called and pledged. But we really need you to come through for us as well, because a radio station costs a lot to operate. That's just the basic facts of it. Media matters for a reason. It's quite an undertaking, and we hope you will step forward right now and call 1-800-439-5732.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.